Sorry. Good morning. Thank you to everyone coming this morning. I will apologize at the outset. The shiur is called from 10:15 to 12:15. If the shiur does go that long, so I do have to leave. I actually have a wedding to go to, of which, of course, I'll say at the outset, there is a prenup being used. But if it does mean that I'm running out and can't take further questions, it's not because I'm running away. So if people have questions at a future point, I would be happy to follow up. The reason for the shiur this morning, as I think is fairly obvious, is because of the controversy that has been swirling in the last couple of weeks. It's actually been brewing quite a bit longer. Unfortunately, I would say that there has been a lot of heat, but not so much light. One of the things that I hope does not happen in the course of this discussion, I don't mean just this morning, but generally, is that the plight of the agunot in these particular situations, in these particular tshuvot, should not be forgotten. We can engage in whatever halachic dispute we want, and the conclusion may be leheter or leisser, but particularly if it is leisser, one has to remember that there are still a whole bunch of women in these cases and in other cases as well who are suffering, and it's a serious problem, and appropriate attention has to be dedicated to the problem. I also, in this context, want to sort of bring to your attention something that this very distinguished chaver of mine, not here, but spoke, we had a lengthy talk yesterday. I'm not really sure all of his information is 100% accurate, but only because I'm hearing a lot of different kinds of information, which are all really irrelevant to the presentation today, to the substance of the presentation, other than to say that it seems, according to his presentation to me, that there are a lot of women who are unable to find a base and to actually be metapel in their cases, to deal with their cases. In situations, what he described to me, and again, I believe that he is convinced what he's saying is correct, and if his sources are telling him the truth, it's true, that there are locations and places where people, women, will call up the Beis Din and will say, my husband refuses to give me a get, and the response is not, okay, well, come here and let's find out what's going on in your case, but rather, call us back when he's willing to give a get. I don't know if that is true, in fact. It kind of staggers me to hear such a thing, but to the extent that it's true, it is, of course, outrageous. And in such a situation, I understand why women are looking for some venue, someone to try at least to deal with their situation. And according to at least this version, that is sort of what the genesis of the international Beis Din is about. I think it also has to be stressed in our particular situation that on some level, there's no such thing as a chumrah. Now, what I mean by that is that, of course, there's a chumrah. A chumrah is sometimes that we prohibit a woman to remarry because she might be an eishes ish. And then also can be a chumrah that if a woman should be allowed to remarry, leaving her chained as an aguna is a horrible, horrible avla. What I mean by there's no chumrah here is that each chumrah produces a kula on the other side. Undoubtedly, from the perspective of traditional psika, there is a chumrah and a kula here. Meaning, when one is endowed, the chumrah is that we are machmir on the prohibition of lo sinaf, of eishes ish, of adultery, and even though there is an expense, there's a cost here, that the woman remains an aguna, we adopt what we might call the shevi al-taseh position, which is generally speaking the bias in halacha. And the shevi al-taseh position here is that she would remain asura. But that's, of course, only true if, in fact, there is no possible resolution to the problem. But if one studies the history of tshuvot on agunot, it becomes very clear that the Gedolei HaPoskim made the efforts to make sure that no stone went unturned. I think it should be stated at the outset that the intentions of all of the parties here are l'shem shamayim. The intentions of the IBD are to solve or resolve the situations of the agunot to alleviate their enormous suffering. And that's something that should never be minimized. Mori V'Rabbi Rav Shechter's response is also motivated 100% L'Shem Shamayim, because he feels that these women, despite the Piskei Din of the IBD, remain agunot. And if in fact that is correct, then telling them that they are permitted to remarry is shever al shever nikra. It's a double avla. It's bad enough that their husbands have abused the privilege that the halachic system has granted them to be the ones in control of deciding to give a get. Bad enough that. And now, when they're told that they're free to remarry, if the community doesn't recognize that, they suffer a second time. So all the parties involved are miskavdin l'shem shemayim. I think that all the parties involved also agree that the situation is a terrible situation, that the plight of these women is a terrible situation. I think everybody also agrees that every legitimate halachic means should be used to free these women. The debate, of course, is over what is considered a legitimate halachic method. I should state at the outset that someone who doesn't like the entire premise of the halachic system, that the power belongs to the man, and would like to alter the halachic system, is fundamentally not part of this conversation. It's a different conversation. I wish too that it were different, but I accept the halacha as binding whether I like it or not. I don't have to be happy about it, but when we decide halacha, we accept its premises, even if sometimes on a personal, emotional, and moral level, we struggle with it. But nonetheless, we are Avdei Hashem, and the bottom line is that we accept the halacha even as we struggle. There are those who have uttered in contexts like this and other contexts where there is a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. I am fairly certain that neither Rav Schechter nor the members of the IBD subscribe to this as a philosophy. The history of Aguna proves that, in fact, this isn't the case. When you read the tshuvos of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, some amazing, complex, lengthy tshuvot, where he resolves some very difficult situations of Igun, really, there was no bigger makel than Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. But nonetheless, there were cases that he wasn't able to resolve. If you look at the medieval period, it's often said that we have a new Aguna situation today, different than the Aguna of the past. It's actually not true. When people make that statement, what they mean is that today, the Aguna situation is where a husband refuses to give his wife a get. And that situation never existed in the past, because when Jewish communities had judicial autonomy, if you didn't want to give a get, the Beis Din made you give a get. They made you want to give a get. Whereas, in the past, the real Igun situation was the husband who disappeared and we didn't know where he was. But that's not entirely true. The Rishonim faced almost the identical situation as we do today. It might not have been the more common case of Igun, but they faced it. And what they faced is exactly the worst nightmare that we face today. I'm sure Rabbi Stern could probably confirm this, that the worst Igun situation is where the husband isn't frum anymore, and he's not part of the frum community, so there is no communal pressure that can be brought to bear. The best you can do is to try to persuade his non-Jewish or non-frum neighbors, who generally don't care, that he's a really bad guy, and if he wants to be part of their chevra, he should be a nice guy. But it's very, very weak. The Rishonim dealt with the exact same problem, and that was the get meshumat. The only way to escape the clutches of the Batei Din in medieval Ashkenaz or Sfarad was if you decided to lead the Jewish community, but in those days, your only choice, there was no such thing as being unaffiliated. Your choice was to be Jewish or Christian or Muslim, or maybe to be Zoroastrian or something like that. But the bottom line was, the Rishonim faced the exact same problem we do when they dealt with the situation of a Meshumad who refused to give his wife a get. Granted, there were many Meshumadim who were willing to give their wives a get. There's a passage where Rabbeinu Tam says that he personally witnessed 20 Gitim of Meshumadim. But if you look at the Tshuvas of the Rishonim, you will see that there are most intractable cases where situations where you had a Meshumad who was nasty about it and refused to give his wife a get. So it is clear in the history of Aguna, of both kinds, that as much as Rishonim and Achronim struggled with the issue, and as much as they might have been lenient in some circumstances, they were not able to solve all cases, despite the fact that there was a rabbinic will. I would be remiss, before launching into the discussion, if I didn't take the opportunity to mention that, to quote Rabbi Stern, friends don't let friends get married without a prenup or something like that. It has always personally been my policy that I'm not Mesader Kiddushin without a prenup. When I got married before there was the RCA prenup, I used Rabbi Bleich's prenup. which in fact is more lopsided in terms of power assigned to the wife. My personal policy now, although I don't always find out, is I will not attend a wedding when there is no prenup being used. And I think that it is a good policy that people should adopt. Others might disagree, but if we wish to rid ourselves of the scourge of aguna, that is the only simple way to do it. It might eventually put Rabbi Stern out of a job, but I think he will make a shecheyanu on the day that that happens. So I would be remiss if I didn't encourage all of you who aren't married, when you get married, you're Mirtz Hashem, you use a prenup, you encourage your friends to use a prenup, you look at your friends funny when they say, I wasn't going to use a prenup, because it has the approval of many huge gedolei olam, and at this point in our community, there was no excuse for not using one. Okay. Now, what I wanted to focus on today, and my students received the email, not everybody necessarily saw the email, some of you might have received it forwarded, I want to simply focus on what I will call the facts. I want to focus on the facts. I think everybody in this room knows that Rav Shechter is Mosak as a Talmud Chacham. I think there are also a lot of people who know Rabbi Krauss. I know Rabbi Krauss a little bit, but I don't know enough to say. There are many people who said that Rabbi Krauss is Mosak to them as a Talmud Chacham. And it could be that both of those facts are completely true. But I think that when there is a debate either about the details or a debate based upon an assumption that someone is muhsak, so it's incumbent upon us to try to clarify the facts. The second Ramah in Yeridea, it's in Sif Aleph, of Simon Aleph Yeridea, the second Ramah comments that Ein lichatchila lismoch ala chazaka b'makob sheyachal levarer. When you don't have an opportunity to clarify something, we rely upon chazakos. But when you have the opportunity to clarify a fact, we don't rely upon a chazaka. And in this particular situation, the way partly to address the situation is to simply clarify what the facts are. Not everybody is capable of doing so. I understand that when Balabatim look at this controversy, unfortunately what becomes is, whose team do I play for? Whose color hat do I like? Whose hashkafa do I like? You know, and that's natural. I don't fault Balabatim for adopting that position. I am a little bit perturbed, however, that Rabbanim, and I think this is true on both sides of this debate, have sort of taken positions without necessarily clarifying, okay, there's a machlokas here, I hold of Rabbi X, but there is a way of determining, to some extent, who is correct in this particular case. At the very least, in terms of the topic of Get Zikoi, in terms of a particular tshuva, if Rabbi X claims this is the way poskim work, and Rabbi Y claims that this is the way poskim work, or they don't work the way you claim, there are at least ways, in a sense, of verifying that. Now, sometimes, of course, it's not easy. It can be not easy for one of two reasons. One, it can be not easy because you have difficulty reading the tshuvot. But that shouldn't be true for people who are Yodei Sefer. The other possibility, which only relates to certain kinds of statements, if I say, no posek ever said X, so it's a very hard proposition to prove, but it's very easy to disprove. Now, I don't claim to have any kind of a kias, and I would never get up and say that I know that no posek ever said that you can or can't use this particular type of get, because I could easily be proven wrong. But if someone says that no posek ever said X, and someone else says, but yes, but this posek says X, so presumably that statement should at least be verifiable, or you should be able to prove it, you should be able to disprove it. You should be able to see whether that posek says X, or at least whether that posek doesn't say X. Maybe there's another posek. If you turn over enough stones, maybe you'll discover such a posek. But at least on that particular issue, one can look at the facts in front of us and say who is correct. In the email that I wrote to my students, and I think most of my students know where I stand on this issue already, and I stand where I stand on this issue not because I hold of one particular person or the other. I stand where I stand on this issue because I have read the relevant shuvot, I have read the relevant articles, I have read the relevant sources, and based upon my reading, I have drawn my own conclusions, really what I would say based on what I see in front of my eyes. I've asked my students to do the same thing. I will not say to you, kablu dati. And if you wish to argue with how I read the text, as I said in the email, I welcome that. Because, as you know from Shir, I'm not always right. I have said that many times. It has been demonstrated to you many times. I see people in this room who have proven that proposition a number of times. Therefore, I would like the debate to take place not on the grounds of who wears a bigger hat, who wears a different colored hat. I would like the debate to take place on the grounds of what are the facts in front of us. I would also suggest in this context, and I want to emphasize this, that when we talk about psak generally and errors in psak, there are two kinds of issues. One is what we call toa bidvar mishnah, and the other one is what we call toa bishikol hadas. I don't wish to relate to the latter category. I'll explain in a moment what they are, precisely because shikol hadas, different people may look at things differently. If I have, what is Toa Bidvar Mishnah? Toa Bidvar Mishnah means when you have a Mishnah, or subsequently, if you have a Halacha Psuka in the Gemara, Halacha Psuka in the Shulchan Aruch. So to misquote that or misunderstand that, so that generally speaking is what we call Toa Bidvar Mishnah. Toa Bishikol Hadas means I have a Mishnah that states X, and now I have to extrapolate from that Mishnah, from that passage of the Shulchan Aruch, how am I medame milsa la milsa? How do I compare my case to that case? And how do I extrapolate the halacha from the known to the unknown? So there, as the Mishnah, the Gemara in Brachos says, Kashem shepartufeim shonim kach deyaseim shonos. No two people necessarily think exactly alike. Now again, I don't mean to suggest that shikol hadas, all opinions are created equal. But nonetheless, it's harder to talk about what are the facts and to be mevarer, to clarify with absolute clarity who is right and who is wrong. So what I asked people to look at with the sources was issues that I consider to be basically Dvar Mishnah. You can look at the source. Does the source say X? Does the source not say X? Now, there are two issues that I wanted to look at this morning. The first issue was the question of Get Zikui. Now, on some level, it's a little bit of a red herring in this discussion because nobody has used Get Zikui. I will spend some time introducing what it is and the various kinds of Get Zikui in a few minutes. No one has actually used it. I think when one read the early news articles when the IBD began, so one of the members of the Beis Din spoke about as if they were going to use this, as if it were a done deal. But it actually has not been used by anybody, and the Beis Din now asserts that they would not actually use it. However, in their response to Rav Schechter, the Beis Din makes an assertion that even though they're not going to use it, they make a certain assertion about poskim, whether some poskim actually consider to be a valid method. So that is actually something that can be subjected to verification. It doesn't speak to the heart of the however many tshuvot the IBD has put out, because they don't use Get Zikui in it, but it does speak to what I would call one of the issues here is the reliability. When I receive, for example, when I get a patur, when I'm a Sadr Kiddushin, and I ask the Chassan and Kala, do you have any, were you ever married before? Are your parents ever married and divorced? You know, were there any gil, were there any conversions in the family? If the answer is no, I believe they're telling the truth. If the answer is yes, this parent converted, this parent was divorced. So the next question I ask, particularly when it's the mother, and if this child is a child from a second marriage, I'd like to see the patur. If you tell me your mother was once married and then she remarried, I want to see a patur from a Beis Din that she was free to remarry. If he shows me a patur, and the patur says that Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, or the RCA Beis Din, issued this get, so at that particular juncture, I know the Beis Din is a reliable Beis Din, it's done. If I don't know who the Beis Din is, and it could just be Yankel Beryl Shmerel, you know, living somewhere in Alaska or in the Yukon Territory, so then I pick up the phone, I call someone who works in the field of Batei Din in the United States, in North America, and I say, do you know anything about this Beis Din? Can I rely upon it? He says to me, yeah, this is a reliable Beis Din. It's done. I don't need to see the basis of the Psak. I don't need to see anything. But the reliability of a Beis Din, even when they're just issuing Gittin, and certainly a Beis Din that is issuing Piskei Halacha that allows a woman to remarry without a get, so I either need to know what the Psak Din was or know that the Beis Din is a Beis Din which has a chazaka. If I receive a letter that was signed by Chacham Ovadia Yosef Zichrono Livracha that says, I investigated the case and this woman is free to remarry, whether he gives a reason, doesn't give a reason, I don't need to ask any further questions. Chacham Ovadia was a baki accepted by all. If I receive a letter from someone who is not of that stature, or someone I don't know who says, I investigated and she's free to remarry, So I'm not necessarily prepared to accept that until I know why. And that is, I think, very reasonable. So the reliability of a source, the reliability of a basin, the accuracy of a basin, on some level, can be crucial in terms of how Rabbanim should be evaluating a psak issued by a given basin. I think we understand that. I think we understand it in every area of our life. So I want to talk about Getzikui, and I want to explain it. And the second issue I want to talk about is a specific psak din that the basin issued that Rav Shechter referred to in his letter. And even before I get there, I want to emphasize one thing. Rav Shechter had certain objections to the psak, and we can discuss those objections. However, I think it should be pointed out, and this I've heard from two different sources, and just reading the tshuva, there might actually be other grounds permitting this particular woman to remarry, which are alluded to in this psak, but are not actually the basis of the psak. So even if one is to decide that this psak is actually not an acceptable psak, perhaps there are ways of freeing this woman using other means. So even if one invalidates a particular psak or a group of piskei halacha, that doesn't absolve us of the responsibility of having a beis din that will look into these cases to try to free these women. Of course, if one accepts the psak then it's not an issue. You're done. But I want to emphasize that just because somebody argues that this psak din is invalid and it's wrong because A, B, C, and D, doesn't mean that there's no hope. It could be that a beis din looking at it will eventually hit a dead end. It happens. But the key to our discussion is simply a question of the facts that are in front of us. The psak of this particular din, of this beis din, and is this psak accurate in terms of what it claims to say and what the sources actually say? That's the question. So let me begin with Getzikui. I want to just read. It's up on the screen now. I want to read the letter because this is the sort of starting point in the discussion. The response to Rav Shechter's letter. In the last paragraph of the first part, at the above-mentioned meeting, Rav Shechter voiced his opposition to implementation of the technique of Getzikui in the well-known case adjudicated by Rav Uriel Levi, the Abbate in the Rabbinic Court of Tzfat, Israel. That case was a situation of a husband who was in a persistent vegetative state. He's not, according to the doctors, he's never coming out. His wife wants to remarry. The problem is, we can't ask him, would you like to give your wife a get, or are you willing to give your wife a get? Because we can ask him that, but Rachmana Litzlan, he can't answer that question. He's not like someone who's an Elaim who can't talk. He can't nod and tell us what he wants. The Beis Din ruled in a very, very lengthy psak that since we can assume, one can debate that, but it doesn't sound so unreasonable to me, since we can assume the husband would want to give his wife a get, because he wouldn't want to keep her chain, because it's not going to make a difference to him, therefore, we can, based upon the principle of not only zochin le'odam shalom b'fanav, but zochin me'odam shalom b'fanav, we can write a get on his behalf. We can act as his shaliach to write a get, because that's what he would want us to do. That is a... If you can read that tshuva, you should be able to read any of these tshuvas. I'm not suggesting it wasn't well written. It is a lengthy and complicated tshuva. I want to emphasize, that is a case where the husband is not refusing to give his wife a get. It's a case where the husband has not expressed his will. We don't know what he wants to do. Now, the truth is, even if the husband had said he wants to give his wife a get, and then went into a persistent vegetative state, it's still not a simple matter to write a get, even though he expressed his will before, but it would remove one set of obstacles. It's not simple. However, so reading on, that's that case. So Rav Shechter voiced his opposition. He thinks that you can't write a get there. Okay. Furthermore, he stated unequivocally, Rav Shechter said, that, quote, no one permits a get zikoi when the husband refuses to give a get. What they mean by this is that when the husband says, no, I don't want to give a get, when he refuses, bepemole, he says no. Not we're guessing what he wants, but we know that he says no. Rav Shechter claims that no one permits a get zikoi to be used in that case. Okay? The argument of the IBD, of one of the members of the IBD in his article, was that we should be able to give a get exactly in that case. That when a husband says, I don't want to give my wife a get, that particular author argues that since it's an objective zuchus for the husband, because he's being a rasha, and by giving a get, he's doing what's the right thing, We know what he, in effect, really wants, and therefore we can write his wife a get, we can be mezakeh a get to his wife, and act as a shaliach, even though he has expressed his will not to give a get. So Rav Schechter claims, according to this letter, that no one permits such a get. So the IBD continues, when further challenged by a ruling of Rav Shalom Mesas, the former Sephardi chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, where he advises the use of a get zikoy even against the expressed will of the husband, and they give you the rest reference, Rav Schechter responded, I hadn't seen that. So according to the members of the IBD, what I would conclude is the following. There is a tshuva of the Shemesh U'Magen by Rav Mesas, where he advises to use a get zikui against the expressed will of the husband. Not like Rav Levi, but where the husband says, no, I don't want to give a get, and he advises, let's give a get. Let's give a get on behalf of the husband, and Rav Schechter was not aware that such a tshuva existed. Okay? Now that is something that, after I explain, I want to take some time to explain get zikui, that is something that presumably should be easily provable or disprovable. All you have to do is go to the Otzar HaChachma, certainly if you are a student in yeshiva, or if you have access to it in any way, or to the library, take out the Tshuva Shemesh U'Magen, Volume 4, look at Tshuva number 100, and look at that Tshuva and see whether it's true or not. That's a very, very simple way of verifying. Okay, so we will do that a little bit later. In the meantime, I'd like to explain sort of the backdrop, a little bit of Get Zikui. There is a principle that zochin la'adam shelo b'fanav. It means that if I want to give someone a gift, but they're not here to make a kinyan, what can I do? I can have a third party make a kinyan on that person's behalf. Let's say Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. Reuven wants to give Levi a gift, but in order for Levi to take possession, Levi has to make some type of a kinyan with Reuven. But Levi's not here. So you know what we're going to do? Shimon is here. So Shimon will make the kinyan on Levi's behalf. That's what he's going to do. So what's the problem? The problem is that Levi never asked Shimon to make a kinyan on his behalf. But Reuven wants to give Levi, you know, a lottery ticket that just won for $1 million. Presumably, Levi would very much like to take that ticket. So we have a principle, zochin l'adam shelo b'fanav. If something is considered objectively a zechus, a merit, Shimon may, on behalf of Levi, without asking Levi, and I'm going to explain one major approach that Rishonim use, I'm going to simplify here, Shimon can be a self-appointed shaliach for Levi and make the kinyan for Levi. Now why does it matter? Why doesn't Shimon just take the lottery ticket and bring it to Levi? Well, the answer is he can. But what we are concerned about in the meantime is that Reuven will say, you know what, I changed my mind. So if Shimon is capable of making a kinyan on Levi's behalf, of zochin adam shel b'fanav, once he does so, it's too late. Whereas, if he's not capable of doing zochin, so then Reuven can change his mind until Levi actually makes a kinyan. So the principle the Mishnah has, I think it's above a Basra and elsewhere, zochin adam shel b'fanav, ve'in chavin adam shel b'fanav, means that you have a principle of zechiyah. That's fine. One crucial point within the principle of Zechiah, which is that if Shimon now takes this lottery ticket and he brings it to Levi, and Levi says, I don't want it. I actually don't want that ticket, for whatever his reason is. Whatever his reason is, perhaps because it's going to make him ineligible for government benefits, which he wants. So it's going to push him above the threshold. I know it sounds crazy, but nonetheless, so if Levi has a reason, as soon as he hears, he says, I don't want it, it turns out the kinyan never happened. Lemafreya, it never happened, and it still belongs to Reuven. That's the principle of zochin la'adam shelo b'fanav, plus the right of refusal when the party first hears about it. Okay. What does it have to do with a get? Well, so far, nothing. Why? Because a get is generally not considered a zechus. A get is not considered a zechus for a woman, because when a woman receives a get, she now is no longer entitled to the support of her husband. For a husband, it's not a zechus generally, because now it's not his wife anymore, so he loses all sorts of privileges. There are, however, one could imagine situations where it is a zechus, perhaps, for a husband or wife. For example, Rashi speaks about zachin for an isha in her get when her husband was a meshumad, and he's available now to give a get. So Rashi accepts the idea. The Sridesh quotes this in his tshuva. that you could be zochen le'isha even though she didn't appoint us as a shaliach to receive her get, because it's clearly a zechus for the isha to get this get from our husband, the mishumat. And you never know, if we wait, maybe a month from now, he won't be around and she won't be able to get her get. So there are situations where you could imagine where it might be zechus for an isha, where we could talk about zochen and isha, zochen le'isha in her get. Of course, remember, in theory, the woman should have what when she hears about the get? She should have a right of refusal. Like, if a person is about to receive a monetary gift, they have a right of refusal. In theory, one would expect that should work. Okay, but, crucial point. In order for the get to work at all right now, it has to be objectively a schus in the first place. You can't do zechiyah misafe. You know, you have something which has upsides, it's got downsides. You can't do zach in there. It doesn't work at all. Even if when the person hears about it, they say, yes, I want it, it doesn't work. I mean, if you bring it to them, and then they make a kinyan, it works. But you can't do zachin when it's not, on the outset, for the kinyan to work at all, when it is not objectively a zechus. So you can't, if a woman, if you're on the fence, whether a woman would want to get, then zachin doesn't work at all, even if she later says, yeah, it's a great idea that you brought me my get. It has to be, unless the woman explicitly says, I want my get, it has to be objectively a zechus at the time that you receive the get. Atin?
Is there anything that we can say definitively is objectively good other than a lottery ticket, even if, let's say, a new dresser, because I know you need it, it could be that it won't fit in your house. And there,
again, there are many things. In most people receiving a sada, again, it doesn't have to be, it's not that there can't be a downside. If there were no downside, nobody would ever refuse. It just means that in balance, you look at it and say, everybody would want this. Okay, so there are three mishugalim who don't want it, or three people of an unusual situation. But it has to be, well, it doesn't have to be an absolute, total, complete schus where there couldn't possibly ever be any downside. It has to be objectively a schus. Yossi?
Why does the woman's will in this case matter if the will is, if you divorce the woman?
So hold on. The answer is, if the woman is here, you're right, it doesn't matter. But to have a shaliach appointed bal kocha, that's a different story. Okay, I may, if we have the time, I may deal with that. Okay. Jeremy?
Why are we assuming it's an objective for the husband?
It's not for him, for her. She can't live with him. He's not supporting her. There's nothing in it. This marriage means nothing to her. All a get makes a difference is now she's without a get, she can't marry, she's stuck. With a get, she can marry. She loses nothing by receiving the get.
Can you say that it has to be as good for both parties?
No. The husband is willing to give the get. If I explicitly tell someone I want X, they can go make the kinyan for me. That's not the problem. The problem is when I don't know at the outset. When they tell me, in effect, I am their shaliach already, right? They can point me as a shaliach. It's when I haven't spoken to them, I haven't consulted with them, that we have to invoke zachin. You know?
So in cases like the Beit Din and Tzfat, if the husband should wake up against the doctor's expectations and says, I wish I hadn't divorced my wife, all the wife's children would be mamzerim now?
We haven't gotten it. The answer is, in theory, yes, but we haven't gotten there yet because you have to climb over another obstacle. Up until now, we've only spoken about zachin le'adam shelo b'fanav. That's nice. Akiva picks up a gift on your behalf. But here, we're talking about zachin me'adam shelo b'fanav, right? Where, basically, without your knowledge, Akiva sells me your field, or gives me your field as a gift. That, obviously, that's normally, you wouldn't expect zachin me'adam. The Gemara never uses such a principle. What is that? What are you talking about? It should be totally irrelevant. So, however, the Achronim, some of the Gedolei Achronim, already entertained the possibility of Zachin Me'adam Shalabafanav, the Chasam Sofer, and Rabbi Yitzhak Ochanan, and there were early authorities, by Mechiras Chametz. Let's say you know that your friend forgot to sell his or her Chametz, and they left Eretz Yisrael, and they didn't even realize it. They're so excited, they totally forgot. So there are Achronim who permit me to go on your behalf and sell, get rid of your chametz for you, even though I'm taking something away from you. Again, remember that it has to be objectively as a chus. And if you come back from Eretz Yisrael and say, Shaita, I didn't want to sell my chametz, whatever your crazy reason is, then the sale never worked in the first place.
Would that be dependent on the grah about how it's a mitzvah for everyone to destroy everyone else's chametz?
I don't think so. That would only be a shaila, I think, if you destroyed someone's chametz and they didn't want it. But here, in terms of mechira and doing zachin, if he refused, you'd also be able to undo it. Zach?
Yeah, I thought we were just talking about in that case, how if he leaves the chametz over, it's essentially worthless. We treat that as a monetary value.
Well, that's why it's an objective zechus.
Okay.
That's why... No, you're not chayv karis for bali rabbi matzah. Only if you eat it on Pesach. That's the only reason why it's an objective schus act. Normally, the reason why you can't sell somebody's object on their behalf if they didn't ask you to is because it's normally not as a chus, right?
My point is that even here, besides the fact that they're doing an avera, it's just
I agree. You could argue that they were doing an avera, but if the chametz would still be worth full value, that you wouldn't call it zachen on them. Enachanami, I agree. But the point is, this is a case where there's nothing in it for the guy to hold on to his chametz, so you're doing him a big favor, and he sustains no loss in the process, right? He's got to buy the chametz back or get money for it anyway. So some achronim entertain this idea of zochen me adam shlomofana. But again, the crucial nakuda has to be that the person has a right of refusal when he or she hears. Okay, so now I'm not going to go further within that track, but now I want to talk about where we have zochen me adam by a get. Zochen le adam by a get you might have in the case that I mentioned in the name of Rashi, which is that if it's an objective schus for the woman to get divorced, then you could receive her get for her on her behalf, even though she didn't ask you to. Now, the Gemara, by the way, says that you can't do that. The Gemara in Yevamos says, at the end of the 15th perek, says, when they talk about a husband and wife who are quarreling, so the Gemara says if they're quarreling, ketata beino leveina, can you receive a get on the wife's behalf? So the Gemara says no, and it invokes that famous chazaka, because tav lemesef tandu, she might still want to be married. So, what the Rishonim say in this case is that Tav L'Meisav Tandu does not apply in every case. In other words, they say that Tav L'Meisav Tandu is because, the Gemara says, Isha B'chol Dehunicha, that a woman, some women, this is the way it should be put, carefully, it's not all women, but there are enough women who would rather be married even to someone who's not so desirable than to be alone. Therefore, you can't automatically assume it's a zechus for her, because Isha B'chol Dehunicha La. So the Rishonim say, yeah, b'chol dehu, but a meshumad is less than a kol dehu, right? In other words, all women have a threshold. That, by the way, is the basis for Rav Moshe Feinstein's maverick position to allow kiddushei tos. The argument against mekach tos is that there are multiple arguments, but part of the problem is that maybe a woman in the end, some woman would want to be married, and therefore it's not absolutely a mekach tos, and you can't free her without a get. That's not to say that there are no situations where a woman would want to be married. And that's what Ramosho's Mechadesh was, that if it's a really big mum, a mum gadol, he was Mechadesh not in theory, he was Mechadesh at Lemaisa. Many had entertained the possibility before. But if it's a mum gadol, there's an umtan the muchach that no woman would want to be married in such a case. And therefore, in the case of Mekach Tos, you can allow her to be married without a get. In the case of the Gemara in Yevamos, there are situations where you can do zachen for an isha on a get because it is objectively a zechus, because no woman would want to be remarried, would be married in that case. Damon?
Is it true that you're referring to about actual mum in the body, or mum as in like about the person itself?
Either. Okay. No, it's usually not a physical mum in the body. It was someone who was homosexual, who was this, that, the other thing. Right? It wasn't. It could have been, but that really someone who was mentally ill before and so on. Those are the kinds of things that mum gadol, they happen not to have been physical blemishes. But the point simply is that even though we say Tav L'Meisav Tandu, there are situations that go beyond that where we say, of course, no woman would want to be married, or of course, a woman would want us to receive a get. Tav L'Meisav Tandu just means that there's a small percentage of women, but large enough as to not create an automatic umdana that we can't make certain assumptions automatically about this particular case. In other words, even in Tav L'Meisav Tandu cases, it might be clear that a majority of women wouldn't want to be married to that person, but that may not be enough to establish mekach tos, generally speaking. Not just in marriage, generally speaking. Yitzi?
I guess sort of going both ways on zachen le'adam and me'adam, just for both directions.
Yeah.
Could I be something for someone in PBS? He doesn't have an option to reject it or accept it, I guess, in theory, and now I'm going to, you know, can I actually give him a lottery ticket, even though he has no das?
That's an interesting question. I would assume that if you hold zachen me adam in that case, you also hold zachen la adam. Now, the fact that he's not capable of making a kinyan physically doesn't necessarily mean that he can't be kona. And we certainly, there you have to explore the sugya of katan, zachen la katan. That would be sort of the analogous case. If you want to explore that further. But I'm not here to discuss Rav Lavi's case. You have to accept that some would say yes. Zach?
Would we use Kedusha Talos if the woman is in this particular room?
I want to sort of bring it back to our thing now, just in the interest of time, we could discuss that at another point. So the first time that Zachen Me Adam that I'm aware of was ever invoked in a Get Zikoy is in the following context. There is a din known as a Hetamei Rabbanim. It's quoted by the Ramo at the end of the first Siman Evan Ezer. In a situation where a man is allowed to divorce his wife, a man should be allowed to divorce his wife, but she won't take the get. In those circumstances, he wants to marry another woman. So we have a Hetamei Rabbanim which allows a person to violate the Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom against polygamy. But one of the absolute conditions for ever giving a man a Hetamei Rabbanim is that he must be mashlish a get with the Beis Din. He must free his wife to remarry. So if she doesn't want to accept the get, so if a Hetamei Rabbanim is warranted, they give him a Hetamei Rabbanim only after he gives the Beis Din a get and said, whenever my wife is ready, she can come. You are my shaliach to give my wife the get. And when she decides finally that she's ready to remarry, she'll go and take it. Fine. That's no problem. What is the problem? Well, one of the situations where Hetamei Rabbanim might be given is a situation where a man's wife is mentally incapacitated. So therefore, he's not prohibited from taking another wife in that situation, but he's required to get a Hetamei Rabbanim. In order to do so, he has to give her a get. He has to be mashlish a get. And if she gets better, she'll then go to the Beis Din, and Beis Din will give her a get, and now she's free to remarry, someone else. But here's the that was the practice for centuries. Before the Chasam Sofer's generation, the Chachmei Lisa came up with an objection, and they said the following. It doesn't make any sense. Those of you who do the Daf Yomi and Nazir, by the way, you just crossed this last week on Daf Yud Beis and Nazir. The Gemara says that anything that I cannot do right now myself, I cannot appoint the Shaliach right now to do at some future point. Therefore, if man cannot give his wife the get right now, because the get won't be chal at all, because she's totally incapacitated, she's a shota beyond shota, right, at this point, she's totally incapacitated, he cannot be megarish her right now by giving her a get, therefore, he can't appoint the Beis Din right now to give her the get. The fact that she gets better later, well, he should have to reauthorize the Beis Din to give her that get, which he presumably would do, but he hasn't done. So the Chasam Sofer, some didn't agree with the reading of the Sugya Nazir, but the Chasam Sofer himself says he thinks that he knows what the practice is, and the Chasam Sofer believed that you follow the Minag L'chum and L'kula. He was an ardent defender Minag Yisrael. Chadash Asim and HaTorah is not only L'chumra. The Chasam Sofer says we know it works. It must work because this is a get zechiyah. This is Zachem Adam. Because we know, the husband already said, I want to give this get. He had the get written. He gave us the get to give to her. So Zachem Adam. Okay. That's what the Chasam Sofer said. There was another case that was very similar. Yes. Zachin Me'adam. You are in effect writing or giving a get, taking it from the husband. You're taking a zechus away from the husband. This is his wife. You are taking a get from him in effect. That's Zachin Me'adam. Yes.
Okay. Even though it is with consent.
Correct. But you're correct. It's a technical problem in the Minar HaShlichus. His will is clear. But nonetheless, he wasn't able to make us his shaliach to give this get. So we are appointing ourselves as a shaliach to take a get from him and give it to her. Yes.
So that's meaning when she comes out of whatever it is, then we're going to be zachim.
Correct.
So in that case, why appoint the shaliach in the beginning?
Because the husband may move away 2,000 miles. The Chasam Sofer says, by the way, he thinks because of that, if she comes out and becomes well, and he's not married at the time, Chasam Sofer, I think, says you have to go back and check whether he still wants to give it. If he's married or remarried, so then it's an objective schus, because he doesn't want to violate the Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom. But if he's single at that point, maybe now he would like to be married to her.
So it's not only a shaliach for him, we need an expression of his will.
Which we had already, and we assume it continues, unless we have a reason to think otherwise. Ruvain?
Why are we assuming once the wife comes out of a registered state that it's still under his foot? What if he would prefer to be married?
Well, he can't divorce the other wife. In other words, again, forget. I don't need... Maybe yes. Maybe you can make that argument. But the bottom line is the normal case is that he remarries and he never comes back, and she may not come out of that state. But if she does, here's her get. Okay? Now, the other type of get that fits into this category of where the husband has expressed this desire to give a get is the tshuvos, and Danny, if you can scroll down a little bit. It was the tshuva of Rav Herzog. Okay, it's the second tshuva after the Chasam Sofer. And Rav Herzog dealt with the following problem. There was a shaliach, I'm not going to read Hebrew, but you can read it. There was a shaliach who used to go around to Chutz Laretz to get husbands to give gittin to their wives, husbands who didn't come to Eretz Yisrael. And he would get a minui hashlichus, and he would get the authorized letter, and, you know, authorized writing that he would be the shaliach to give the get. Wonderful. Even at one time, he got behind the Iron Curtain, and he was able to get husbands who just weren't, either couldn't get out of Russia, weren't interested in getting out of Russia, so they were happy to give their wives a get. But then a problem happened. He returned to Eretz Yisrael with his file of all these authorizations, but he died. Now, technically speaking, once he dies, the shlichus is betela. But we know what these husbands wanted to do. We even have it in writing. It might not be technically good to make a shaliach, but we know what they wanted. So some of the gittin, they were able to get reauthorizations, but some of them, they couldn't get back to those places. They couldn't get back beyond the Iron Curtain. In this case, Rav Herzog was judging whether it was being done whether or not one can use get zikur here. He had dialogue and correspondence with very junior colleagues whose names happened to have been Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Shalom Yosef Elyashiv. And in this particular case, Rav Shlomo Zalman thought that you could not use get zikur here. Rav Elyashiv thought that you could, and in the end, Rav Herzog was machriya like Rav Elyashiv. Okay. So that's a little, you know, more of a chiddush, because there we don't have the shaliach that the husband appointed. But nonetheless, what's clear is in both of those cases is the husband wants to give a get. That's get zikur. That's the easiest to use, where there is very broad support for it. The next step down is a situation where the husband is silent. In other words, we don't explicitly know what his will is. We can intuit, we can guess, but he's silent. For example, the first time this was suggested that I'm aware, and Rav Herzog and the Sri Desh quote this, was by a Talmud Chacham Rav Kalatskin after the First World War, when there were many husbands who didn't come back. So he wanted to be matir the wife to remarry with a get zikoy on the following grounds. The husbands were either dead, in which case their wives were free to remarry. I assume it was a situation where the wives had children, so there was no yibum, chalitza shayla. Either they were dead, or if they weren't, they were choosing not to come back. They didn't care to remain married to their wives. And therefore, they would want to give a get, and therefore we should be mezakeh get. Now, these disappeared husbands never said or gave any indication they wanted to give a get, but he wanted to sort of intuit, to be matzil these agunos, he wanted to intuit that of course they would want to give a get. We could agree, we could disagree, but that was a situation where the husband had said nothing. Rav Herzog himself and most of the poskim rejected this. Rav Herzog, in his dialogue with the Sri Desh, it actually is in the packet, it's on that one sheet at the end of this section, the Rav Herzog says he thinks the yesodos are ri'uim, the foundations are weak, he doesn't agree to it. In his Chubos, Heichal Yitzchak, which is, I think I also put in the sources, he explicitly says, Chas v'shalom, we'd ever use such a get zikoy. But there were at least one major figure who did entertain such a possibility. Zach, do you have a question?
It seems like the kind of classic case of an agunah.
I know. So you're
the Mishnah.
Agreed. It's a very, very difficult. It's a very difficult argument to make. You have to. What Zach is asking. Let me spell out what he's asking, which is, you know, the case in the Gemara, which is a chumrah the rabbanon of Mayim Shalem himself. A man falls into the Atlantic Ocean in the middle of the ocean. You don't find his body, and you didn't see him swallowed by a shark. You can't let his wife remarry. That's the din the rabbanon of Mayim Shalem himself. So why don't you just assume that even if he came up alive on the far shores, that he's just choosing not to come back? So you have to say that in that case, it's possible he's unable to get back because transportation wasn't the same in those days. Whereas in post-World War I, the assumption would have been, again, I didn't live at the time, I couldn't tell you, if Kalatskin's assumption was that the Metzius was, that people could have traveled at that point and he could have gotten back. But what Zach is saying is that if you can't draw that distinction, then Rav Kalatskin's psak by definition is wrong, because otherwise the Chachamim would have used the same thing in Mayim Shein himself. But you can make a distinction. But methodologically, what he's saying is crucial. In other words, if the Mishnah clearly doesn't assume, or the Gemara doesn't assume what you're working with, and you have no way of distinguishing, then you're wrong by definition. I'll come back to that by the third get zikoy in a moment. Rav Lavi's decision in the Beis Din Tzfat is the same type of case as Rav Kalatskin, although arguably it's a better decision, where there the husband is here in front of us, but he is not capable of giving a get, and he will never be capable of giving a get, nor of living what we would call chaya ishus. Now, I think that if I took a poll in this room, I'll take a poll amongst the gentlemen in this room. Chas v'shalom rachmana litzman, if you were in a persistent vegetative state, and the doctor said, You were never going to come out of it. Would you want your wife to be free to remarry? So I'll ask the question this way. Who would still want to be married? Who would like their wives to be given a get under those circumstances? Okay? All right, so I think everybody here would agree. It's the way I set it up at this point, I don't think who would dare have not raised their hands, but okay. So the point is, I think a reasonable person could assert that's an under the muchach, that the husband, as long as he'll be taking care of whatever institution, would want his wife to be free to remarry. I think it's a reasonable assumption. There still may be technical problems. Despite the fact that the husband would want to give his wife a get, you might still require authorization. That's not a simple issue. But I think his case is better than Rav Kalatskin's case. Okay. There certainly are poskim who thought that you can have such a get zikut. The issue at hand, however, which the IBD highlights in its tshuva, is there ever a case of get zikui against the expressed will of the husband, where the husband says, no, I don't want to give a get, and we say, but we know that really it's his chus for you, and therefore we'll give a get on your behalf. So here, before we look at the tshuva, the only thing I want to look at really is relevant to the response, is Rabbi Sasse's tshuva. I'll look at that in a moment. But I want to make the following observation, and I had a debate with Rabbi Krauss in Highland Park last year on December 25th. The recording is available online. I don't know if the source sheets are, but if anyone needs the source sheets, I'm happy to provide both mine and Rabbi Krauss's. There are two facts that should tell you that such a get zikui is impossible. Number one, which I can say I was mechaving to, but the Achronim already said, is the following. The Mishnah in Gittin says that if a man doesn't want to give his wife a get, and he is mechuyev to give his wife a get, kofero sa'achim marotzani. What that means is we take out our whip and we beat him and we say, would you like to give your wife a get? And he says, no. And then we beat him again and again and again. And we will beat him near the point of death until he finally says, yes. The way we would say in contemporary terms is we offer him a choice. Your wife can be an almana, or your wife can be a grusha. You choose. Now, striking a person when it is unnecessary, including for the shaliach beis din, violates a Torah prohibition. If the shaliach beis din gives one more lash than is necessary, you violate the prohibition of striking another person. If beis din, when a husband was obligated to divorce his wife, that's the only case where one dayan has proposed that we use zachar me'adam ha'get. If when a husband is mechuyev lagaresh, beis din can be right a get zechiah on his behalf, there would never, ever, ever need to beat the guy up. He says, I don't want to give a wife a get. We say to him, we know you say you don't, but you really do, and we'll act on your behalf. End of story. You wouldn't need all the blood and guts here. There'd be no need for gore. And in fact, to do so, when you had a simple option of just writing a get zechiah, should violate a Torah prohibition. Very simple. Number two, and this is ha'ara that somehow I didn't see it was in front of my eyes, but it was my wife's ha'ara, which was already observed by the Sri Deish, is that the Rishonim had the same problem of a get meshumad, and the Rishonim, when they couldn't solve the problem, and no one said, Zacha me'adam, let's write a get zechiah on behalf of the Meshumah. It's a very simple solution. It's such a simple solution. Why didn't they use it? The answer is because the Rishonim did not consider such a possibility viable. Yes?
Leah? Why is it, I understand that you're saying, like, they didn't do this then, so we shouldn't do this now, and I hear it, and I respect it, like, especially when you consider Masara, it's fine. But what if, like, in today's day and age, we do consider the woman's emotional suffering and the physical suffering she could be going through, and they didn't necessarily do that then. I mean, not to the same degree in care that we do now.
I refuse to accept that contention. I refuse to accept the notion that Rashi and Tosfos were fundamentally emotionally less sympathetic to the plight of Agunas than we are today. And yet, and nor do I think that's true if you take, I mean, I know you're not going to do this because none of us are going to do this. Sit and read through the Tshuvas of Yitzhak Elchanan. The man spent his life writing Tshuvas to free Agunas. No one is going to tell me that he cared any less passionately for these women who were stuck than you or I or anybody else today. I just categorically refuse to accept that. But more to the point, you know, in the case of the Chacham, in the case of the Mishnah, is a stronger argument for two reasons. In theory, I would never do this and nobody would do this. But you could argue on the Rishonim. You can't argue on Chazal. That's by definition halacha. The Rishonim didn't use a get zikoy, but the Chachamim used something worse than a get zikoy if it were viable. They violated an Isser Torah if a get zikoy were an option. And that to me is totally inconceivable, that they would have struck a person repeatedly, shelo l'tzorech, because that's what it would mean. So I think both are good rayas, but there's no reason why the Chachamim would allow kfiya to do that which would be an issur d'oraisa if you had another option. And I don't believe that they were any less sympathetic. I don't believe for one moment. We can't prove that contention, but I will go on the record as stating that I think that the Gedolei Harishonim and the Gedolei Acharonim, and some of them we can point to because we can see their Yegiah and Amala. I don't accept for a moment, you could disagree, I don't accept for a moment that they were any less compassionate towards Agunot than we are. I don't think there's a shred of evidence to that contention. Maybe you're right. I can't prove it. I can't bring them back from the dead and ask that a psychologist to examine them, but I don't think there's a shred of evidence to point that they felt any less strongly than we did. Rabbi Stern?
When is the first time you find the concept of Zachin
Me'alva? I think there is one Rishon who in his comments, I think it's a Trumas Hadeshin, who might be mashba the concept, not by Mamanosishu. I think it's a Trumas Hadeshin that the first time Mizachim Adam, and maybe a little earlier where one of the Bishonim says something and they infer from that it sounds like he's assuming there's Zachiah.
Well, so that being the case, is it possible that here's a halachic vehicle that because we're standing on the shoulders of giants, contemporary poskim have thought of, and the Rishonim hadn't considered as a possible tool to use?
So again, here's what I would tell you. I believe methodologically, it's an important question, from a halachic perspective, methodologically, I believe that you can say that when you have a new situation, and they didn't face the same situation, and this tool would only be useful in this situation, you could say they never mentioned that tool because they never faced that situation. But if they did face the situation, then I believe methodologically we always argue that the argument from silence is a valid and binding one. In other words, if the Chachamim or the Rishonim hadn't faced our situation, if the idea of a nasty husband who was Mesarv Lagarish was only a modern invention, post-Enlightenment, then I think you can make an argument, and you hadn't had the Mishnah about Kofin, I think you can make such an argument. But once you have the Mishnah and the Rishonim adopting the positions they adopt, facing the same situation, and there's no new technology here, right? It's not like we have anything that they didn't have in technology and so on, then I think you have to assume. I just think the way Psak Halacha, one of the ground rules is that the argument from silence is a valid one. Yitzi?
So I guess it was the law of Pen Yosef.
So
that law, I guess, limits Shigul HaDas, say what the Gemara and Rambam discusses, the idea that a Beit Din can do what's necessary. So when we talk about doing what's necessary, so that is limited, meaning they will only ever, hit someone or beat them or whatever, when they feel there is
no other option, or no other better option, let's put it that way. In other words, by a field, if you owe money, Beis Din goes down and collects from the chassam. They don't beat you until you do that. As they could, that would be an alternative way. Why should they bother? I presume the answer is that Yordan the chassam, one of the reasons, is because they don't need to strike the person, right? You use the least, the least bad form of coercion. Okay. So, yes, Jeremy. If it's unnecessary. Beis Din is authorized to do kfiya, and that's mutter. That's mutter midaraisa, mutter midrabanan. But if a shliach Beis Din uses unnecessary force, he gives an extra lash, they normally talk about in the context when you're supposed to get 39, or if they strike him shelo litzorech because he's already agreed and he's doing it, so then that violates lo yosef. The Gemara says, mefirish, minayin on a shliach Beis Din shehosef ritzua achas. And while the Gemara is in the context of formal malchus arbaim, I don't think there's any reason to assume it's any different by kfiya. It's not Makas Mardus is for an Issa Durabanan after you violate it. The difference between Malkus, normal Malkus, whether it's Doraisa Durabanan and Kfiya, is Malkus Doraisa and Makas Mardus in a certain sense, there's no Kapora for it. You have to get the Malkus. You violate it, however you get that. Kfiya, how many lashes do you get Kfiya? Well, it depends how strong or smart you are, right? Kfiya could be one lash. Kfiya could be showing you the lash, or it could get 100 lashes, right? If you eat chazir, you can say, I'm sorry, as much as you like. They say, we understand you're doing tshuva, that's great, but you still get 39 Malkus, right? So it's not, I don't want to call it Makas Mardus. Kfiya is something else. No, it's based upon, I think, look in Sanhedrin. I think it's in the first parak. There's a drasha about shotim v'shotrim. I think what they talk about with suasad dayanim or something like that. But somewhere there's a makor. The notion that maybe shotrim may itself be the makor. The idea that you have shotrim have to enforce the rulings of the Shoftim. Okay? So now I want to come back to the proposition or the question of, does anybody ever authorize get zechiah? Rav Shechter asserted, so let me, before I go, let me make one more comment. The issue in the tshuva I referred to before, the Sri Deyesh, it's in the packet. I only have one page. It's a very long tshuva, the Sri Deyesh. Rav Herzog's letter and tshuva comes a little before. It's much shorter, but I gave you sort of one page in the middle. In fact, if you look at that, let's go there for a second, rather than you, because one of my themes is don't trust, verify. As my students know in Shir, when Tosis quotes Rashi, some of you heard me say, okay, does Rashi really say that? And did you bother to check whether Tosis is correct or not? So if you go to the page, Danny, see if you can find it. It's right before the IBD's decision. It's only like 5-6 pages in. Okay, so if you look here, I'll show you where it is here. I'm going to read to you what it says here. He says that, I'll translate. I'll read it in translation. I'm starting with Bavadai. So he says that it is known to you, the heter that Rav Kalatskin provided, of Zikoy Haget for a husband who disappeared in war, and he relied upon Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, who said, Zachen Me'adam. Adam. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan didn't talk about by get. He spoke about by Mamonos. So he relied upon it. And he says, and this guy doesn't care whether his wife, it makes no difference to him whether his wife is his wife if he's alive, because he hasn't come back. And some said to me that they did this mice in Warsaw. However, Aval, Misupkani Biyasodos, I question the foundations. The ode, here's the part that I want. The ode Shani Choshesh, Im Nasa Davar Kazeh, even if we were to do what Rav Kalatskin suggested, I am afraid, Shalotetze Mizeh Chorva, that a total Chorva will occur, Sheyasu Gitin Al Korchon Shabalim, they will write Gitin against the will of the husband, Hainu Lo Shekofen Oso Al Pidin, Acheu Marotzani, not that they'll beat him until he says, yes, I want to give a get, he says, I won't give a get, and we say, but we'll do it on your behalf anyway. Ukvar ire koze beItalia, there was a maisa like this in Italy, shehabased in Shalahem, pasku lesader get b'shviel bal sha'amar b'seiruvo, they paskin to write such a get, v'telegrafnu alehem shehabonim yiyu mamzerim. We told them, you do this, you give this woman such a get, she remarries and children, they will be mamzerim. And it appears that they backed away. Rav Herzog is explicit on this. But okay, perhaps some would disagree with Rav Herzog. So here I bring you to the last tshuva in this section, which is the tshuva of Rav Misas. So what the IBD says in its letter to Rav Shechter, in response to Rav Shechter, is that Rav Shechter said, nobody ever holds of get zikoy when the husband has expressed his will against giving a get. And they claim there's a tshuva from Masas. Rav Shechter said he hadn't heard of that tshuva. So I'd like to look at the case in the tshuva. It's very simple. Firstly, beginning of Simon Kuf. Danny, can you go back? It's back. It's earlier. In. Oh, I'm sorry. You're looking. I'm sorry. I didn't recognize it. Kibalti meis harav agadol per adar hamishel natsiyan hagon ravad Yosef Shlita psaktin sheshocho lo rabboni Brooklyn lahaskim olaf. The bunch of batei din in the United States had a case. They wanted to permit the woman to remarry on the basis of kiddushei tos. What did they do after they wrote their psaktin? They sent it to Chacham Ovadia. V'shalach eilo l'chavos dati, Rav Ovadia sent it to Rav Misas for an opinion, not because Rav Ovadia couldn't paskin himself, he was the gadol, but he didn't have time. He was very busy, so he asked Rav Misas to look into it. What was the case? Ha'inyan, Bachura Achas mi Beis Sefer Beis Yaakov. He had a Beis Yaakov girl. Niseis Mechodesh Cheshvan Tavshin Samach Aleph Lebachor Echad Adaita Shu Ben Yeshiva. They made a shidduch with a kolot, with a guy they assume was in learning. And then, Ad Kidekach, they thought so highly of him as a yeshiva bachor, Shetzara Isha Kiblu Alatzman Lazor Lezug Li'arba Shanam. Apparently the price back then wasn't a cash value, it was how long they would support them for. 4 years. V'shuv nota, then it turned out after the wedding, shezeh shana v'chetzi, it was a year and a half, and I assume before the wedding, hayabayla gone b'tedirus mechose nachosa skumish shehiu v'meshach hazman l'sach masayim alaf dollar. The guy was embezzling money, he had stolen $200,000 from a relative. V'habal hoda ashmasa l'fnei shofet arkoi. He admitted his guilt in secular court, and then what did he do? Ubarach. He fled. Gam noda la shebala roazonus. It turns out now her husband regularly consorted with prostitutes. Shuholech lebate boshes umaskir son. He would go and hire them. Isha. As soon as she heard that, Ozva also, Vitabba based in get Piturin. She demanded a get. Uvidiun Shiskayim Shalobafanov. There was a din Torah that happened, not in the husband's presence, which is a little odd, because you normally can't have a din Torah when one of the parties isn't there. The reason they had the din Torah was because he didn't show up. Sheshamu Tainer Sah, Vero Rayo Sah, they heard her claims. As an aside, in the next tshuva, when Rambasah specked out of his head there, you know why he claimed the husband wasn't there? Because he was in jail. He was in jail. That's why he wasn't there. Because he couldn't be there. So, anyway, what did they paskin? Pasku sha'al habal lagaresh es ishto miyad. This Beis Din Yerushalayim, which I don't know where this Beis Din is. I know we think it's in Yerushalayim, but most of the Batei Din were in America. It might be a Beis Din in this country with that name. I'm not sure. So they paskin, he's chayav to divorce immediately. V'kofeno so, turn the page. You force him with whatever means to force him. Where's the husband? What did he say? V'ha-ba'al nelam. The Baal's gone. He's not there. U'mishpachas ha-ba'al rotzin l'schov kama milyone dollar u'mishpachas isha. The husband's relatives want to extort money to reveal his whereabouts, wherever he is. Not even clear they knew where he was. Gam his himu she'muchanim linko nakom v'lishpochtam im yikaimu apsak shalakfiyah. They're threatening violence if they try to force the husband. So where was the husband in all this? What did he say? Nothing. Did the husband say he wanted to give his wife a get? No. Did the husband say he didn't want to give his wife a get? No. He didn't say anything because he wasn't here to say anything. As it turns out, he was in jail. The tshuva continues. I'm not going to read it. It happens to be many poskim, I get the sense more Sfardim, are reluctant to rely upon Mekach Taos alone. They always want another tzad. Because allowing a woman to remarry in the grounds of Mekach Taos, it may seem strange to you, but it's a big chiddush lemaisa after Nisuin to allow such a thing. There are gedolei poskim who allow it, but there are a lot of poskim who want another tzad. So Rav Misas put together in the original tshuva two tzad, Mekach Taos and the sakana to the woman, because who knows, this guy picked up AIDS from one of the prostitutes. Okay. At the end of the tshuva, if you turn to the next page, the second to last paragraph, okay, there are two more things that he has to say. Omnam, I think the word should be re'eh. He's referring to an earlier tshuva, it says in volume Gimel, which is not in the packet, but if anybody's interested, it's on the computer. In fact, if you don't believe me, Danny, just do an alt tab, switch windows for a second. Okay, this is chelek Gimel, and he's referring to this Milui Evan in the paragraph labeled Gam. Okay, now switch back, just so the people are reading. Omnam ra'isi re'ei b'sifri aniskar simen chav zayin, that's chela gimel, amud reishnun tes b'shem ha'miloi evan, which I have not been able to find the original sefer, sha'acher sheherich lahakel b'zeh, I think it was a Mekach Taos case, you'll see in a second, rak shematza l'makom hatzala a'av de b'chozos kashar davel hakel. He was reluctant to rely upon it. However, rak shematza l'makom hatzala me'igon l'zakos loget b'shlichus habatel b'al shalom idaita. Mishum d'schus hulo, ayin sham. You can add into this get zikui, based upon what the Milui Evan wrote. Now, what was the case that he's dealing with here, Rav Masas, where he's suggesting l'chumra ba'alma? It's not the basis of the heter, by the way, but you could use his get zikui. Is it where the husband said he wants to give a get? No. Is it where a husband says he doesn't want to give a get? No. It's where the husband isn't there, like Rav Kalatskin, like Rav Lavi. Is it a case where the husband expressly refused, as the IVD says in its letter? No. If you look back to switch for a second, if you look back to the this in the case, to the Chela Gimel, what was the case of the Milui Evan? Just all tab. B'shem Milui Evan, Simen Chav Tes, B'mi Shenelam Achar HaChasuna. The guy disappeared after the wedding. V'amekadesh Yisnai B'derech HaMeshugayim. And Mekadesh seemed to be a crazy guy. What did the husband say in that case? Did he want to give his wife a get? No. Did he refuse to give his wife a get? No. He wasn't there. So it seems very clear to me, unless I'm missing something, that the tshuva of the Shamashim again does not say that you can use zika get against the expressed will of the husband. Zach?
So was the guy...
Okay. Yossi?
I was just confused. The tshuva that you were referring back to... Is that a different
tshuva? Of Rav Masas, yes. Chela Kimmel.
Okay.
Simen Chaf Zayin test, something like that. Adin?
Is it possible that we could read this case in which, let's say Rav Moshe didn't know he was in jail, but it is mm-hmm. he's Ne'alam, but it's, we assume, unless we assume he's dead, it's still within the possibility that he could give it if he wanted to.
You should say better. It's possible he could say no, but he didn't. That's the point. Rav Kalatskin's case, it's possible the husband would come back and say, no, I don't want to give my wife a get, right? It's always possible. That's not the point. The point is that we have three categories. We have the case where the husband has expressed his will in favor, a case where he's expressed his will against, and a case where we don't know what he wants.
The ones in which we don't know what he wants, we're looking back to the times of Rishonim, where it might have really been impossible, in the situation that, let's say the husband was stuck out in China or something like that, it would have been impossible for him to do it if he wanted to. But here, the fact
impossible to come back, you mean, or what?
Yeah, impossible for him to give the get if he wanted to. But here, the fact that he could have very easily, he chose not to, could that be
so again, sort of... Again, the whole point is that Zochin works on the principle that he would want to do it because it's a benefit to him. And that's all great until he says, no, I don't want to do it. Right? You can use Zochin up until that point. So the crucial issue, has the guy refused? Or done something to make it clear he's refusing? And the answer is, no, he hasn't in this case. David?
Not just that, but also, it's not like the actual basis.
Correct. It's also, he throws in a sniff, I agree. But I'll put that point aside.
No, but he's making it as if it was like the basis.
Forget that. I want to raise the question. Has anybody ever suggested in any way, as an ego or as a sniff, that you may use get zikui against the express will of the husband? And the answer is, at least, I don't know every tshuva, but the Beis Din mentioned this tshuva, claims that it says that Rav Masas held that you could use, in some fashion, a get zikui against the express will of the husband. I ask you to look at the tshuva, and does it say that or not? That's all. Chaim?
So, it doesn't say it explicitly, but, again, in accordance with actually after having read the tshuva, they're sloppy and they're sort of like checking out the sources, so it could be that when they read Rav Masas, they saw, oh, his family's demanding money, that he must have told his family to demand money, therefore I don't want to do it. Of course, it's a terrible reading, because if that had been what he said, and he'd been like speaking to his family, then Rav Masas probably would have mentioned that.
Yes, and it's also, we happen to know in retrospect as well, that wasn't the case. The guy wasn't in hiding, he was in jail.
Correct.
Right. Yeah,
if you read it that way, you could have come to the incorrect conclusion. That's the only way I could possibly imagine reading it that way. If you assume due to the like weird phrasology,
you're explaining how someone could have misread the tshuva.
Correct.
Okay. Fine. Yeah. I asked you the question: does the tshuva say it or not? And the answer is no. Okay. Binyamin.
Does the tshuva say explicitly that Rav Masas knew the family had not consulted with the husband?
No. Here's the point. He repeats several times that the husband isn't here. If he knew that the family had consulted with the husband, he presumably would have introduced that. And more significantly, when you look at his precedent, when he talks about the Milui Evan, that's exactly the case that we're dealing with. The husband, you know where he went. Meshuggah disappeared. Okay, so that is part one of the IBD's response. If you think that I'm misreading the tshuva, you should disagree with me. I think that the tshuva is black and white. Now yes.
What was the actual outcome of this case?
In the end, in the next tshuva, it's on the page. You can read it if you want. The one other point, I want to make one other observation. I didn't read the last paragraph of the tshuva, and I think this is important too. V'chol zeh tzarech haskamas pe'er hador hagon Rav Avad Yosef Shlita v'chashar yigzor ken Yaakov. In other words, Rav Masas was a pretty big Talmud Chacham, that Chacham Avadya said, could you please take care of this? Before issuing this psak, he sent it back to Chacham Avadya for his ishur. Okay. Yes. I'm sorry.
Where? The actual outcome
of it, the end, it turns out the guy was in jail. He tested negative for AIDS. Okay. So Rav Masas didn't have there was Mekach Tos, but he didn't have a second Zad. And the guy claimed he's willing to get under certain basic conditions. It's not clear whether they were reasonable or unreasonable. So he wasn't willing to paskin at that point without a get. He backed out. That's not my point. That's kind of irrelevant to this. You can read the next tshuva. It's on the page. Danny?
How exactly are we differentiating between the second and third categories? Is it a specific expression of I do not want to give the get?
Yes.
Or is it?
Yes. In other words, it the expressed will of the husband, not he doesn't want to give a get.
In other words, like if all indications are pointing to the fact that he won't want to give a get.
So here's the story. If the guy is not in front of us, but his messengers have sent us a message that he's refusing to give a get, that he doesn't want to give a get, that is one thing. But that's not what's described here. I understand the family wants to extort money, but there's no, and it's clear from the next tshuva, he hasn't expressed any will one way or the other.
Well, is that
In the next tshuva, it's very clear.
Well, he's in jail.
Correct, but he said he was willing to, he claims even he was willing to forget. But the point is, here's the story. Up until that point, we didn't know where he was, but the question is, could you argue that Getzikoy is another tzad? Right? Nobody would ever, he didn't even use it. It was thrown in at the end. But even if you did, right, it would be on, it might very well be that the husband stepped forward and said, no, I didn't want that, that we would accept it. But in the meantime, because he's not here, could you even advance such a taina? Is there a question in the back, comment? Okay. Jeremy, and there's a last question on this. I want to move on to the second half because we are limited time. Yes.
So in this tshuva, it seems like even though he didn't expressly say that he's the last to divorce his wife, it seems like it was pretty clear from the fact that he did not want to divorce his wife. The fact that he originally married her, he happened to be a more person, but he wanted to continue with his lifestyle. It seems. Where is he in the indication that he wanted to divorce his wife? That he did not want to divorce his wife.
We didn't see any indication that. That he was against divorcing his wife. That's true. We didn't see any indication one way or the other, though. I'm willing to put it in the purely neutral grounds, but the bottom line is he didn't say, he didn't express, he didn't say, what's that? Maybe. In other words, the point is that it's possible, it is possible, I'm not arguing against that. It's also possible if Kolotskin's case and Ralphie's case also they want to stay married. The question is, would you ever argue we could talk about how, for Rav Lavi, how much probability do you need in order to say he wants to give a get? But when a person says, I don't want to give a get, that should be pretty clear what he wants or doesn't want. Right? Does anybody say, when he says, I don't want to give a get, that we can do that anyway? That's the question. And the answer is no.
I'm just confused because the only basis, it seems like, for giving a get was that it was a Mekhtar
event. Well, no, it's not the basis for giving the get. Is that since he's not here and he's mechuyev lagarish, he's doing that's part of the IBD that ruling in Zika, that article in Zika get is it's only because he's a mechuyev lagarish. So he's doing we're really doing him a favor since he's mechuyev to divorce his wife. We're doing a mitzvah on his behalf.
Why is this different than the case described in the Mishnah of Gittin? It's also mechuyev lagarish.
Correct.
And he's still coping with himself. It's not sufficient. You can't do it with something else.
Exactly. That's why the Mishnah proves that you don't have such a gezeiko. That was exactly my right.
Right. Here, in this case, he is mechuyev to give a get.
And he hasn't said anything.
He hasn't.
So maybe in this case, and he's also not in front of us to do kfiya in this case. But the point is, he has in the Mishnah, he said no, and we don't use zikui, we use kfiya. All right.
And just the last point, just to bolster your point, which is the next siman, which I just quickly read through, proves the whole thing. Which says that in the end, they say the mechachtos is wrong. I'm being chozer on my psak, and the husband wants to give a get, but he wants to take down the advertisements against him and
right.
Things like that. And he says, and he needs to give a get, and no mention of getzikui.
Correct.
And he doesn't getzikui was strong enough. He did just say that's
even when he watched, he says he wanted to give a get.
Right.
Okay.
And still no getzikui.
Yes. Although arguably there you could say he didn't need it anymore if he's willing to give the get. Right? Once you found him and he says, I'm willing to give the get, and just take down the posters. So rather than using getzikui, take down the posters and let him give the get. Right? Okay. But I think it's clear there is no such tshuva that says, there might be a such a tshuva, but this tshuva does not say you can give a getzikui when the ex-husband has said, no, I don't want to give a get. The second part relates to, now I want to turn my attention to the Ritva. I hope we have enough time. I did not intend on spending as much time, although this is more educational, I think, than some of the aspects of the second half, just in terms of presenting a full sugya. So the case, I want to read the psak quickly. But actually, before I read the psak, let me give just a little brief background. The Torah says that al pishnayim edim o shlosha edim o al pishlosha edim yakum davar. The question the Mishnah asks in Makos, it's in the sources, is if the Torah tells you two witnesses are enough, why does the Torah have to tell us three witnesses? The answer that the Mishnah gives many answers. One of the, and they're all MS, and they don't argue on one another necessarily. One of the answers that's given is that just as when you have two witnesses, if it turns out that one of those witnesses is disqualified because they're untrustworthy or because they're a relative, they're karev apostle, therefore the Eidus falls apart. Why does the Eidus fall apart? Because you only have one witness now. One kosher witness. So too, if you have three Eidim, if one of the witnesses is disqualified because of karov apostle, then the Eidus falls apart, even though you still have two kosher witnesses. He invalidates the entire kot. That's what the Mishnah says. Now that obviously, as Rebbe claims, I think Rebbe or Riose, one of them claims, that it's only true by dine mamonos, it's not true by dine nefashos. Because by dine nefashos, ma yasu b'shnei achim sh'rel be'echad shehargas ha'nefesh. What do you do if two brothers witness a murder? You're going to say, that's my new strategy. If I'm going to kill someone, I'll bring along my brother, and I'll be miyachin him as one of the eidim for the reticha, and now I'm going to be free. Because, sorry, I'm miyachin eidim. Nimsa achim ekar b'pasol. That's ridiculous, obviously, on some level. But whatever the reason it's ridiculous, it's wrong. But that's the problem the Gemara confronted. Now, this is a very, very complex sugya, which I only want to touch the surface of to get to the Ritva. It's quite complicated. If you actually go back and read Rabbo Aaron's tshuva that is referenced in the IBD's decision, I think it's Simon Yud is the really long one. He has a lengthy shakla v'taya quoting all the shita. So the Rishonim, it is not a simple sugya. The big machlokas harishonim is over the following. How do we determine when witnesses are a group? As opposed to, they just happen to see the incident, but they're not part of the group. Some rishonim say that the way we determine whether edim, krovim, or psulim are part of a group and invalidate the other witnesses depends upon what their intent was when they saw the action happen. What was their kavana? Did they have kavana lahayid at the time they saw the murder, or they saw the kiddushin, or they saw the monetary transaction, or not? That is one shita, which obviously you can imagine could create real complications. The other shita, that shita is the first one, that's the one the Mechaber quotes, and some claim the Shach thinks that's the Igar shita. There is a block of Rishonim from different angles that believes that Edim only passel a group, Karav or passel, when they come to Beis Din to testify. If they don't show up in Beis Din to testify, then they won't invalidate the other witnesses, which is much easier to work with. Now, how is that relevant to our situation? So the Ritva came up, quoted a big chiddush that his Rebbe, it doesn't say, but I assume it's the Ra'ah, Rav Aaron HaLevi had. And that chiddush was as following. And then the Ritva, by the way, he doesn't say this there. The Ritva belongs to the Beis Medrash of the Ramban, in effect, who believe that Karav or Pasul only invalidates a group if you go to Beis Din to testify. So you would think, well, this should have no relevance whatsoever to a wedding. Because after all, at a wedding, nobody's testifying. Usually, it's rare that later that you even have to go and testify that a couple got married. But the Ritva says the following. Let's actually read the Ritva. There's one thing that's worth reading. Let's see it inside. The Ritva. The Ritva can be found, okay? Someone says, page 14, it's at the bottom of a page. The Ritva, where the print gets big, okay, begins with the word mihu. Danny, can it be blown up a little bit in this? Because knocking off the page. Okay, a little better. Okay, the Ritva says as follows. Mihu. Kol heicho sheyesh ba'oso maimit ksherim upsulim okroven, tsarach liyachet eide akidushin. If you have relatives standing under the chuppah, or mechalal Shabbos, the Ritva says, you need to be miyachet edim. Why? The ilo, kevan de'iko eid pasul b'nehim, edus kulam b'teila. If there's one eid pasul there, like the father or the mother of the chassan, then the edus is b'teila. The af al gav da amri lemechsei asina, and even if they say, our intent is not to testify, but rather just to watch, The Ritva says, nonetheless, it's still a problem. The chi amrinan hasam in the Gemara Makos, tamrinan lehu, we ask the witnesses, lemechsei asisam, olas hu de asisam. When we ask them that question, the i'amar lemechsei asinan, tiskayim edus b'shar, when can we ignore them as pasul witnesses and accept the kasher witnesses if they say, I only came to watch? Hainu b'dinei mamanos u'b'dinei nefashos, che'ein ha'edus miskayemes at she'boin lebeisdin, ushas re'ia lo chashiva edus. The Ritva says that is by every other case of testimony except for Kiddushin. Kiddushin is unique. Why? Aval hocha b'kiddushin ein ha'edus ba la'ames hadavar bilvad. It's not what the Gemara uses the term later in Kiddushin and Daf Samachay, I think. Edus is levarure milsa, lebirur hadavar, but rather, ela, it's lekium hadavar, ala afilu yadina and dahacha kushta de milsa. Even if we know that a guy and a girl did kiddushin privately, he gave her a ring and said, nonetheless, ena mekudeshes below edus. V'ein l'kiddushin kiyum b'lo edus u'gzeres ha'kasav hu. The witnesses of the who witness the kiddushin are the ones who make it a kiddushin. You can swear up and down, both parties can agree, they can take a shua b'nikitas chayfetz that they got married. If there weren't edim k'sherim to witness the marriage, they are not married, even though we believe it, that's 100% correct. The chaylon became the ritva says, since that's the case by kiddushin and kiddushin only, shas maisa hu shas edusan, the chaylon de'ika tzer psule edos imahin, edos kulan betela, dumya the ba'alma, like every other case, kishish tzer psule edos, kishabayin lahay, but based in, she'ein this kulan betela. Now the chiyam rina lemerse asison, o lasude asison, hainu hecha da asul merse b'shas maisa. That's only when the shas maisa in effect is different than the shas edos and based in. So that's what the Ritva says. You better be miyacher edim, otherwise your kedushin won't be valid. Kach hora rabbeinu natzurach banu parke halacha lemaisa. That's the way the Ra'al Paskin. Now the Ritva, his Rebbe, the Ritva says, aval ein zeh das ha-mefarshim zal. But that's not what the mefarshim hold. V'roi lahachmir. The Ritva acknowledges that this does not seem to be the practice. Interestingly enough, in Makos, in the first parak, he contradicts what he writes here. He says it's not a problem. But here, he presents it as the shita of his Rebbe, the Ra'al. Yehuda.
Doesn't he usually refer to this? The Ra'ah usually not, no longer alive when he was writing, and the Rashba usually is? Would this sound more like the Rashba?
I don't think he... it's almost certainly not the Rashba, but it doesn't matter for our purposes. Whoever it was, the Ra'ah was a great Rishon too. The bottom line is he says it was his Rebbe Shita, but it doesn't seem to be accepted. In Makos, he says differently, but here certainly it is the Shita of his Rebbe. In Makos, he seems to say it wouldn't be a problem because it's only in Beis Din. By Kiddush, says it explicitly. Chaim?
A note of what's considered to be made of Kiyam versus Shas Maisa. So I understand how you could apply that here, but for those who, like, so how do the Rishon deal with the case of, I mean, the Mishnah which talks about Edus Chodesh, where it says that basically, like, even if they both show up with intent explicitly, we both intend
to. I want to focus the discussion now because of the limits of time. So, our Sugya. This is the Shita of the Ritva. This would mean the following. This would mean, according to the Ritva's Rebbe, if you had a chuppah and you were not miyachei the Edim, and there were any Edim psulim watching, they would not be married. I think by that definition, I wouldn't be married. Now, it's a question of what yichra Edim means also. The question is, do you have to have the chasam miyachei Edim? Is it enough that you just call witnesses up? But if you didn't call witnesses up, and the chasam was a miyachei Edim, according to the Ritva's Rebbe, it would seem that the kiddushin should be invalid. This is a minority shita, but that is what the Ritva's Rebbe said. Akiva?
Wouldn't nowadays, since we normally do a shtar in addition to the chuppah, wouldn't
no,
we
don't do a shtar. We don't do a shtar today. It's a ksuba, not a kiddushin. Okay, so...
What does he mean by tzeres ha-kosu? Which kosu does he
mean? That edus has to be l'kium ha-davar by kiddushin.
What kosu is he referring to?
It's a problem in the sugya. Yakum davar. The problem is the pasuk is by Mamados, all the Rishonim asked that kasha. But it's based upon the pasuk of Yakum Davar. That's what we mean by Edus Lakim Adavar. The problem is that pasuk is Dine Mamados. So the Rishonim deal with that question. Okay. So now I want to go back. With that Ritva in mind, the question is, does anybody hold of this Ritva? I mean, it's a nice sheet. That's nice for Lundus. Let me correct that. There are lots of people, starting with the Ketos HaHoshen, that they started to be miyachid edim. I don't, because when I first was Masada Kiddushin, I sat down with Rosh Hashanah, I asked him a whole bunch of questions, and at least to me, what he said was, he doesn't think it's necessary to be miyachid edim, and therefore I am not miyachid edim. I do call up to witnesses, but I'm not miyachid edim. Okay? But there are a lot of people, a lot of Rabbanim Masada Kiddushin who follow this tradition, starting with the Ketos, that you should be miyachid edim for this reason. Okay.
Sure, the bigger issues, though.
What's that?
Meaning, being choshesh for this, let's say you find out, like, post-facto, that they were related, that means that now your entire kiddushin is good. As opposed to if you had been choshesh for the shita, then you could have, in theory, had the...
Okay, the assumption as a mesader kiddushin is that you don't just miyachid edim, you ask the witnesses. You know, my line is under the chuppah, I ask them, are they related to each other, related to the chasam kala, has either of them kindred of a felony in the last 5 years? You know, I don't ask them in the chalalei Shabbos, because that much I tell the chasam kala, when you pick your edim, they have to be shomei mitzvahs. That line is a joke. But the point is, it's upon the Masadar Kiddushin to check. I don't need to see their entire history, but at least I ask. You're right, it could invalid. If someone is miyachid edim, you expect them to ask some basic questions. It doesn't need to be see their shidduch resume, but you expect them at least to ask a few basic questions, right? Because sometimes people, innocently, they don't realize. He puts on the yarmulke for the wedding, but the guy's in Ochel Neveil Sotrezos, he's never shown a Shabbos in his life, and nobody knows. So it's your job as a Masadar. If you're going to be miyachid edim, even more so. Okay. So anyway, I want to go look at the Psak Din for a moment, just to understand what the basis of the Psak Din was and the relevance of the Ritva Shita. If you turn to the Psak Din, not the response, but I think the response, if you read carefully, confirms what they wrote in the Psak Din. I want to go to the second page before the decision. The entire discussion up until the paragraph, however, relates to the question of were there kosher witnesses, which seem, according to the decision, if you read it, there were, appeared to be, possibly two kosher witnesses, the Misader Kiddushin and the non-relative under the chuppah.
That disappears from a photo.
What's that?
They didn't ask him about who the Edom were as much as they said from a photo.
I'm giving the best presentation that I can of the tshuva in this regard. Right? In other words, they don't talk about anybody else at the wedding in the audience either. There's a very important issue, tshuva, the Chasam Sofer, about this question of people who are not under the chuppah, but who have an umdana, the kiddushin took place. The Chasam Sofer held mikudeshes. Okay, I just want to. So, but I'm going to put all that aside. Many Acharon Dofa, the Chasam Sofer, they believe that there were two kosher witnesses, possibly, probably, maybe under the chuppah, the Mesadir Kiddushin, according to what they write in the tshuva, the Mesadir Kiddushin plus another non-relative. Now, at some point they say they don't know whether the non-relative was Shomer Mitzvos, but they don't produce any evidence that the non-relative wasn't. But at this point in the tshuva, they are accepting. Not later, they'll raise that issue again. At this point in the tshuva, they're working with the assumption, let's say there were two kosher witnesses, the Mesadir Kiddushin and the non-relative. Now, they want to argue, but there are all these other non-kosher witnesses there, the relatives and so on. So, if you look at the paragraph right before, however, yet, the question is whether the actual presence of ineligible witnesses who have no intention to testify to the act of Kiddushin will invalidate an eligible witness. According to the majority of Poskim, the rule of if any witnesses is relative or invalid, the testimony of his null is in effect only if the ineligible witness intended to be a witness to the Kiddushin. Okay. In our case, it is clear that the presence of these persons was only for the purpose of being onlookers rather than serving as witnesses. So up until this point, they say, there's no basis for disqualifying the two kosher witnesses on the basis of the presence of the Krovim. However, there exists the position of the Ritva in the name of his teacher Ra'ah. It's not actually cited as the Ra'ah, but probably as the Ra'ah, which is cited authoritatively by Tzitz Eliezer and others, that in the absence of designating the witnesses, if there are present both eligible and ineligible witnesses, that the testimony is invalid. In contemporary times, Rav Tzion Bayaron, a dayan serving on the Beit HaGadol of Yerushalayim, has ruled on numerous occasions regarding the propriety of acts of Kiddushin in accordance with the Ritva's view. Now I ask you, when you read that paragraph, what is the position of the Tzitz Eliezer and Rav Aharon in terms of using the Ritva as the primary basis for allowing a woman to get out of a marriage because there were possibly witnesses along there? Chaim?
It sounds like that's the primary reason.
That is the primary reason used by the Tzitz Eliezer and Rav Aharon. Now, if you're not sure about that, read the next paragraph. In our case, in the decision. Am I missing something here?
Also, the first, however, is where he also never tested that. If you go, scroll.
One second. There, I need this one more piece here. Hold on. I don't care about the next part. Where do they talk about it as a sniff? In the last page. They really focus on the Ritva until then. And they talk about whether there were two witnesses. But at this point in the tshuva, they have concluded that we have the basis of the Ritva. And now they say, the basis of permitting her to remarry is the Ritva. Now he says, they say, in light of the fact that some poskim argue that Ritva's posture may only be utilized as a sniff. Now I want to look at that sentence for a moment. When you say that some poskim argue that Ritva's posture may only be utilized as a sniff, what does that imply? That there are poskim, wherever they may be, there are poskim who believe the Ritva may be used outright. But there are poskim, there are some poskim. Okay, but it certainly implies that there are some poskim who do say you can use the Ritva as an ikar. Okay. Fine, you're going further. Some poskim argue the Ritva's posture may only be utilized as a sniff because it is rejected by others or a questionable halachic view. That's the explanation of sniff. And therefore, because it's rejected by others, and therefore may only be appended to other halachic arguments in order to buttress a specific ruling, we enumerate additional doubts which support a leniency. Now, without reading the next paragraph, I'm going to tell you that if you read carefully, there are fundamentally two other doubts. One is, were there even two valid witnesses under the chuppah? And the reason why that's complicated is, A, because we don't know who the other witness was on the one hand. He might, maybe he's not a Shomer Shabbos, although if you want to disqualify him, you have to present some evidence to that fact. Two, the thing that confuses matters here is that there are some krovim who might only be pasul mid rabbanan according to some shitos. And if you have someone who's only pasul mid rabbanan, what is the impact on a deraisa level on the kiddushin? I don't want to get into that case. I don't want to get bogged down in that. The bottom line is they actually present two other tzadim. Most of the material they write is to try to establish the possibility that there weren't two kosher witnesses there. Number one. Number two is the last line. Finally, Mr. Scheinman's claim that he is not Jewish raises a doubt regarding the validity of the marriage. Now, just from a sort of methodological presentation of Psak.
Like
what's that?
It's just kind of like a bomb that they dropped.
Forget that. Forget that for a moment. I want to talk about that in a moment. When we talk about utilizing something as a sniff, read any tshuva. The way a tshuva is written, look at Rav Sasse tshuvas. You present solid grounds, maybe one, maybe two, as to why you think X is muta. Whatever, it doesn't matter what area you're in. And then once you present at least one, sometimes two really solid bases for permitting whatever it is that you're permitting, and then you say, oh, by the way, there's also this shita, there's also that shita, there's this third shita, you throw in the kitchen sink. That's what a sniff is. Assuming that you cannot use the Ritva as a primary basis, this tshuva is just adding other snifim, which are not explored. In other words, maybe the husband isn't Jewish. But clarify a little bit. Maybe the guy under the chuppah was a mechala shebis pasul. They write that, I think, earlier in the tshuva. We don't know whether he's observant or not. I think they said that early on. They state that somewhere. Oh, was that? Is that where it was?
Yeah, so it was in our case.
Which page is it?
Page 2.
Yeah, end of the
first line. You're unable to ascertain.
We were unable to whether he was a Torah observant Jew at the time of the wedding ceremony. Okay, so if you can't ascertain that, well, you need to make some determination. But okay, certainly it's a sniff. That's all it is. It means we don't know. Right, so what we have here then, for those poskim who don't think that you can use the Ritva as a sniff, is we have three snifim. The Ritva, maybe he wasn't Shomer Shabbos at the time of the ceremony, maybe the husband isn't Jewish. Right, so there's no ikar in the tshuva if you don't believe that the Ritva can be used as a primary basis. But I want to go, Chaim, I want to explore that now. In case you're not sure that this is the intent of the Beis Din, I think if you look at the response to Rav Shechter, I want to read from the statement of Bittul Kiddushin. This should be the first page. And I want to read Bittul Kiddushin. At the meeting, Rav Shechter also criticized the psak rendered by the IED because it relied upon the opinion of the Ritva, a minority view. In fact, the decision relied upon the position of the Ritva, and in the name of his teacher, the Ra'ah, which is cited authoritatively by Tuishonim, namely Rabbeinu Peretz, Rav Yehuda, the son of the Rosh. Okay. It's still a minority opinion, but fine. Moreover, the late Rav Elezer Waldenberg, that's the Tzitz Eliezer, and Rav Tzion Baron, who's the author of the Shari Tzion, and a rabbinical judge serving on the highest basis in the chief's rabbinate network, namely the Beit Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim, have both endorsed Ritva's position. Now, endorsed it as what? As the basis or as a sniff? Read the next paragraph. To be sure, there are many authorities who disagree with Ritva's view and contend that his position may be utilized only as a sniff and therefore cannot be relied upon as the sole grounds to void a marriage. I think it's very, very clear that they are saying that the Tzitz Eliezer and Rabbo Aron believe that you can use the Ritva as an ikar, but there are many who disagree and say it can only be used as a sniff. So there's only one simple question that I have here. Do the Tzitz Eliezer and Rabbo Aron say that it may be used as an ikar? Because if they do not, it means that the tshuva that they wrote is null and void, because there is no basis whatsoever, no ikar, for permitting this woman to remarry. If the Tzitz Eliezer and Rabbo Aron do say that, so then you can point to one major posek who says that you can rely upon the Ritva as the ikar and then add on snifim. It's a very simple proposition that should be subject to proof or disproof. Now, again, you theoretically have to read all the tshuvas of Tzitz Eliezer to know for sure, but I am going to rely upon their citations in the original decision to see whether the Tzitz Eliezer says it or not. Chaim?
You'd also have to assume that Ritva himself actually holds what they're...
Even if the Ritva doesn't, other Rishonim might. Chaim, it doesn't matter. If there are Achronim who adopted the Ritva's theoretical position, that would be acceptable as well. Okay? If. So let's take a very, very quick look. You'll have to read this on your own, but don't trust me, okay? You might hate me because you'll take a lot of time to read the Tshuva Tzitz Eliezer. I only present the Tshuva Tzitz Eliezer. You can see it's a rather lengthy Tshuva. I put most of it in small font because I didn't expect my students to read it all. But after a long, long discussion about Edom Hu Psulim Hu Machale Shabbos, all sorts of things, when you get to the end, when you get to very late in the Tshuva, you get to Ostest, Al Ha'amor, on top of what has been said until now, which were some very solid grounds for invalidating the Kiddushin. Yesh Lizkor Gamzos Ki Arito the Kiddushin Dach Mem Gibel Kosav Sham Rabozal Sham Kosav B'Shem Rabozal and the Rabbim Kaimi Kavase. Many hold like that. The Chol the Rachlo Miyachet Edim Ksherim the Kiddushin Os Keva the Ika Bein Anochachim Krovim Mispato Gam Edus Haksherim, and he tells you to look elsewhere for people who may mention the Shita of the Ritva's Rebbe. What's that? I understand. Now, how does the Tzitz Eliezer quote this? Is this the Iker of the Tshuva? Slight.
You scroll over 2 pages to get there.
Yes, a small print. But it's not just, I could have covered this up. Read the Tshuva, you'll see. This is not the basis of the Heter at all. I want to look at, I hear you're going to hear, you'll have to decide who you trust, unfortunately. You don't have to decide. I will make available for anybody who wants. I took out only a piece of Rabbi Aron's Tshuvos. There are 3 Tshuvos footnoted in the IBD's decision. You don't go back, Danny, but I'll just tell you. They say, Rabbi Aron in many Tshuvot, and they write there, Evena Ezer, they give the Chelek, and they tell you Simin Tes, Yud, and Yudal, 9 through 11. I went through the Tshuvos. I had to skim at certain points, but Tes I read, and most of the Yudal I was able to get through. Yud is very, very long. I will tell you the following, and I may have missed something. I didn't see any mention of the Ritva in Tshuva Tes, but I could be wrong. It could be I missed it. I saw the Ritva mentioned in Simon Yud, although he didn't wasn't using the Ritva as one of the Snifim Lakula even. He just mentions the Ritva as part of the Lumdus, whatever else. In Simon Yud Aleph, the Barbaron most definitely uses the Ritva. He cites the Tzitz Eliezer. Now, that's the part that I pulled out, and I wanted you just to take a quick look at. It's in Yud Aleph. In Yud, I believe I gave you the Siyum of the Psak Din, where he doesn't even mention the Ritva. That's where he summarizes. In Yud Aleph, okay, I gave you just the beginning, the Shaila. And the man was, this was a mental illness, which the claim was there before the marriage, but she didn't know about it. And then, if you go to the top of, this is not the original, he cites the Tzitz Eliezer fully, that paragraph, and now if you go to the second to last page that I've given you in the Tshuva, and I think it is the second to last page, Danny, you have it there? Resh Aleph on top. Just so you could see that Rav Aron does quote the Ritva, by the way, he does. On the second, right column, the second paragraph, right at the top of the page, Ukvar Hivanu Le'el Divrei HaTzitz Eliezer, Disvaras Rabo Shel HaRitva, Rabim Kaimi Kavasei, V'ayim Marsham, Shetzireit Shita Zola Sniff. It was a sniff thrown in earlier. I gave you the last part of the Tshuva to write Kitzuran Shel Dvarim, which is the last page, Os Chof Gimel. You'll read it yourself, but what you will see is that in the Kitzur, how does he cite the Ritva? Not at all. It didn't even bother to make mention in the summary of the Tshuva. If you go to the end of the Tshuva, by the way, he was Matir. He was Matir in this case. He writes on the bottom, last paragraph on Resh Beis, V'chol zeh im yitztarfu leheter gimu mori hora, v'chein kvod marasa harava of Rishon Letzion Shlita, and if you could, that was Rav Amar, and if we could get the Mofei Sadavar Ovadia. That was what Rav Aron wrote. He thought this woman could remarry, but only if Rav Amar would be maskim. You turn the page, and you get to Rav Amar, and you will read, number one, Rav Amar's Haskama, and then, I think so, is it not on this tshuva? I think it's the previous tshuva. What? In the previous tshuva, where he did something similar, you will see Rav Amar's Haskama, and then you will see Chacham Ovadia's Haskama. Okay. So now, I think, unless I have read something wrong, and yours certainly can disagree with me, I think it is clear the following. There is no source that is presented in the IBD's Tshuva that actually claims that you can use the Ritva as the Ikar of any Heter for a woman, you know, to be a validated Kiddushin. I think you can read the Tshuva itself also, and I think it's clear not only in the way they present it initially, but in the response to Rav Shechter, what they said, and that seems to be the primary basis of the heter. And if that is the case, unfortunately, I don't think that there's any heter that exists, at least on the basis of their tshuva. Now, I want to point out, I had conversation with the Talmud Chacham in Eretz Yisrael, who had written sort of a broad letter of support for the Beis Din, what happened, looked at the cases, someone I respect very much, and we went back and forth in a very respectful conversation, where he said when he first saw the tshuva, he looked at it quickly, he hadn't seen it yet, I sent him the tshuva, he said he was not sure whether the problem was with the signon or the tochen, the style or the content. After spending more time in it, he says he thinks that it's poorly written, and really what the tshuva was meant to be based upon was the last line, which was that the husband isn't Jewish. Because the Hebrew tshuva quotes a very prominent Dayan, Reb Duchovsky, who says something. He didn't give a letter. They just said, and the Hora Zakein, Reb Duchovsky, something. Now, I spoke to a chaver that I mentioned earlier at the beginning of this year, who thought that there really was a basis for Heter, not the Ritva, but rather the fact that the claim is that the Masada Kedushin is not even from, in which case you don't even have two Edim who might be Shomer Shabbos there, which in itself might be very valid, would require investigation. But I think what is clear is that neither of those forms the basis of this tshuva. What it does mean is that it's very possible that if a Beis Din were to sit down and relook at this case, maybe there would be grounds for allowing the woman to remarry. And it could very well be that I'm only addressed one particular tshuva here. I don't want to say, even though it's tempting, and even though it would be instinctual, that yilmod sasu min amafurash. Right? The way you establish ne'emanus, the reliability of a Beis Din, is to look at what they produce. And then, once, if you see a track record of producing quality, then you assume that even when you don't have the chance to look at it, you assume they produce quality. If you don't see, if what you read does not seem to fall in that category, then you have to be very concerned. Then you really have to treat it at best on a case-by-case basis. I think that is a fair and objective reading. I want to stress again, I don't want the fact that I think when you look at the facts, when you look at Dvar Mishnah here, that it's clear that there are really significant problems with at least this tshuva and the response to Rav Shechter, even on Get Zikoy. That doesn't mean that there's no way of finding a Pesach for these women. It doesn't mean that any one of the other tshuvas is bad. It could be they're all wonderful except for this tshuva. But it means that they have to be looked at carefully. And I want to add sort of another point. And Rav Shechter made this comment in his letter. And I want to be honest. I think in fairness, I think that there are effective ways of putting forth positions when they might not be popular, and there are ways that are not as effective. I believe in the contemporary situation, the world in which we live, in our community, which ironically prides itself on independent thinking, on independent engagement with what's going on, that so many people have taken an opinion without actually looking at the sources. It's ironic. But I think that in the world, in our community, where Das Torah is not, you know, in vogue, and I'm not saying it should be, I think that when you provide, when you present opposition to something, when it's possible, you should spell out Berachel Bitra HaKetana. Why? Say, this is what the Beis Din said, this is what the Ritva says, this is what the sources say, and this is why I think it's wrong. It might be correct that one party or the other is wrong, but in the dialogue of our community, it's not, whether it should or shouldn't be, it's not effective. And if people assume that Rav Shechter is a Talmid Chacham, and people assume that Dayanam and the IBD are Talmidei Chachamim, so then the only way to make your case is to actually present the data. Sometimes it's hard. I don't think in this particular case it's very difficult. I think that the data here boils down to use the language I used earlier, a Dvar Mishnah, and not a Shikul Hadas. Now, I want to add something here, and here I think it's fair to be critical of the Beis Din, no matter what you think of the substance of the matter. If you read the tshuvas that I sent you, and you read tshuvas and tshuvas and tshuvas, one of the common themes that emerges is that after a Beis Din has engaged in turning over every stone and the proper shach levitarya, they then go and they send, after they've really done their due diligence, they send their tshuva to a Adam Gadol to give an ishur. If someone like, for example, Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, who many of you know who he is, or someone like Rav Nota Greenblatt, who most of you probably don't know who he is, but he's probably the biggest bucky in Gittin in this country. I have a Memphis connection, so I know who Rav Nota is at least a little bit. So if Rav Nota or Rav Dalio Schwartz signed off and said, Ani Maskim, I wouldn't even think twice. If you sent it to Eretz Yisrael and Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg signed off it, or probably Rav Boaron, or any number of other Gedolei Yisrael who have expertise in this area, I wouldn't think twice. You know, it's like Ein Botkin min HaSanhedrin Ulamala. Right? Very simple. But if you're not on that level, and I don't think, I would hope and I don't imagine the IBD would claim that they're in that same category, that what they are Rabbanim, who are Talmidei Chachamim on a certain level, who are trying genuinely to help these women, I think that the appropriate thing to do, whether this Beis Din continues in whatever form it continues, is that any Psak Din you issue should be sent to Gedolei Yisrael for review. It's very simple. If you're making an obvious error, they'll point it out. If what you're saying is really solid and you present the evidence, presumably you will find others who agree with you and we can be matzel these women. That would be a mitzvah gedola. But to write shuvos without receiving any shur of this nature, again, you know, getting a get is one thing, right? The ksav is mochiach by a get. But allowing a woman after nisuin to remarry without a get, that is a radical, radical concept. I don't know if you find it, you know, pre-Rav Moshe or how much before that Rav Tzvi Pesach found. I don't know if you find it. Kiddushei Taos, which is a broadly accepted concept as the basis to allow a woman to remarry after nisuin without a get, I don't know if before the 20th century. I don't want to say for sure not. I don't know of a case where Kiddushei Taos alone was the basis of letting a woman remarry without a get. I'm not saying, I don't want to tell you, Lo Ra'isi certainly is not a Raya. But in reading the later halachic literature, it's the impression I get. So these are not, you know, what I like to call the Asher Yatzar Shailas. These are chamuros of the chamuros. What's at stake on one hand is a woman remaining in Aguna. It's an incredibly cruel fate, and it is a profound Chilul Hashem. It's a bigger Chilul Hashem than almost anything else, because here it's not just that a woman is being mistreated, but that the halachic system is being taken advantage of to do so. On the other hand, the prohibition of losinaf, of adultery, is not minakalos, it's jehreg v'al yavor. And the potential consequences of it are mamzeris, for which there really is no takana. And therefore, it's our responsibility to do everything we can legitimately within the halachic system to free these women, but with the emphasis on the fact that it has to be legitimate. Because to do so in a fashion that is not legitimate is a double cruelty to these women. They have suffered badly enough already. And now if you're going to write a psak halacha that is not going to be accepted by a significantly large part of the frum community, in fact, almost the entire frum community, you're not only not doing them a favor, you're sticking a knife in them a second time, even though that's not the intent. So our job as a community, I think that something, it seems to me, based upon the metzias I've been told, is that there needs to be something like the IBD that's trying to pick up all the cases where other batei din, for some reason or other, won't deal with it. And again, sometimes the beis din won't deal with the case because there is no case, but sometimes they won't deal with the case because they're not doing their job. And there needs to be a place, people who think that beis din isn't treating them fairly, another beis din at least to look at it. But that beis din can always write a decision. All they need to do then is to run it by bigger Talmidei Chachamim, people of outstanding stature, and then with God's help and with a certain amount of Yigyan Amala, we will be able to save them as well. Yes, we have a few minutes for questions, but at 12:15, I make like a pumpkin and I disappear, whatever it is. Judah.
So they do say in their responsible chapter that to be sure, there are many authorities who disagree with Rinpoche's view, and therefore cannot be relied upon. But then they say, in a careful reading of the entire Psak, it comes clear that the IBD decision also offered five other reasons in support of its leniency.
So yeah.
You're saying that the rebuff, meaning that the rebuff, you're saying there that still the rebuff is
the ikar. The
other five
things
were...
Yes. There actually, by the way, are not five things. I'll tell you where the five things are. I can tell you which paragraph they're in, and they're actually not five things.
There's three substantive of the same thing.
There are basically two things. That's what I was mentioning before. In the paragraph, in light of the fact, they then present, we enumerate additional doubts. If you actually cut to the chase, and that's not inherently bad, there are two sfeikos. One is, were there possibly two kosher witnesses there? And who could have been a kosher witness? The Mesader Kiddushin, the other non-relative, and relatives are only possible by the Rabbanon. That's what it's all about, to establish that maybe out of that whole bunch, you don't even get two. And the second thing was, maybe the husband isn't Jewish. I think that there's where you actually break it down. They actually are only two. There are five sentences, but two tainus.
So they had just reversed the thing and said, the husband's not Jewish, and then said, by the way, we also have the mikvah, would have been a different tshuva?
It might have been, provided that you engage in a discussion of, how do we know the husband isn't Jewish? What's the basis for that? What edus do we have? Right? What are the chazakas here? Then you could have written such a tshuva. Right? That would have made sense. If you had written a tshuva that said there were no two Edim Kshayim there, the guy was a Mechal Shabbos, we know it for that reason. And by the way, there's also this Ritva, it would have been a different discussion. But it's clear to me, it's not just the order in which it's presented. It's that the other things are presented as maybes. I'm not even sure they qualify as snifim, given the fact that no evidence, at least in the tshuva, is adduced to that. And again, there might be evidence, Judah. It just, you can't write a tshuva that doesn't present that. What is the evidence?
Just to add a Rabbi Stern. Point to that. In the original Psak Din, which I have a copy of, they originally wrote the wife...
I have that a copy too. And the original Psak Din, they have no mention of Rav Dachovsky either. In that last line.
Online, Rav Dachovsky is not in the Hebrew one either.
Not in the English either, that's correct. But I have the... What's it? I thought so also. Someone told me it is. But either way, I've seen a Hebrew version that someone in Eretz Yisrael sent me with Rav Dachovsky in there. I saw the original English version. It was the wife said, the Tova'as. I understand. I understand. But even Naniach that it's true, that he said it. At the end of the day, if you want to make that the Ikar, you can't just say, maybe. Right? Yitzi.
Even though the Tzitz Eliezer is only mentioning that, okay, some people use it as a sniff, he does say that, many hold by it.
I understand that. So that means there are a number of other Rishonim who mentioned it, or maybe. But if you look through the halach, I so far am talking to a colleague of mine, again not in yeshiva, who's working on this ritva. He said he has yet to find. He thinks maybe he's found somebody who uses the ritva as one of two major pieces, but he hasn't yet found that. He hasn't proven that yet. Nobody yet has brought to light a case where the ritva is presented as an ikar or even as a major thing in that.
And just as, I guess, a follow-up, so the idea is, I don't know, halacha kabat shrai, and the fact that, there were some Rishonim, obviously, who held by that, but now that the Achronim have rejected it, so it's, halacha kabat shrai, and we're just not going to, or...
So I will tell you, personally, firstly, I'm not a bar hachi, and I'm not one who's directly involved. I follow my Rebbe on this, not only because I follow him, but also I think it's mistaber. I find the position to be a difficult position. I think Klal Yisrael didn't accept that ritva. And despite, if you look at the Shach, who doesn't quote the ritva, but he says things that could be construed as being very much like the ritva, I think that's not the Minhag Yisrael. I think in many communities, for hundreds of years, they were not miyached edim, and no one assumed they were psulim. So I think that Minhag Yisrael rejected the ritva. But if the Tzitz Eliezer wants to use a sniff, I have no standing to say, no, you can't use it as a sniff. So, but I do think that the ritva is a position that was really actually rejected. And even though they're post... But again, I'm not a posek. I'm not writing these tshuvos. I'm not a bar hachi to argue on them and to deny their right to use that. But I still don't think anybody has shown anywhere where the ritva is the basis of a hatha. Shua?
About how to move forward and one thing you said about the prenups before, that's sort of like a two-part question.
Yeah.
One, how successful are prenups? And two, is there a way that we can have, maybe a chasan under the chuppah be set shlichim to write the get for when he would become a ma?
Okay, so I'm not going to answer the second one because it would be so complicated simply because he could be mevatel the shaliach before we would do anything.
But is there some way to make it that he could be mevatel later?
No, not really. I don't want to go into it. Let me just answer that question. How effective is the prenup? So what I have heard, Rabbi Stern will agree or disagree with this, I've heard in the name of the BDA that any case they've ever had a situation where there's been a prenup, they've never had a problem. Now, I know what you say in Araya, but I even get the sense there are cases where husbands have made noises about the get, and they pulled out the prenup, and that was the end of the noises about the get. And I want to add one nekuda about the prenup, which I think is very important. The prenup not only prevents igun, it also prevents using the get as a tool to extract things that shouldn't be extracted. When I spoke in Highland Park, Professor Chaim Seyman, who's a fine, who's a alumni himself, who's a professor at Villanova, so he moderated, and so Chaim said at the time that someone did a study of divorce settlements in the Orthodox community, and from a monetary perspective, women made out statistically consistently worse, and it's hard to prove that, but the thinking is that even when the husbands aren't ma'agein, they use the get as leverage. I might be ma'agein if you don't make me a better settlement, and I believe that it's very important for that reason alone You know, in Teaneck, if you had to live in Teaneck, from the perspective of Egon, you wouldn't need a prenup because you couldn't daven in any shul in our community if you were a ma'agin, and you'd get thrown out. But even if, of course, you could just go to Brooklyn or you could go to somewhere else, whatever. But even without that, I think the prenup is really important because it prevents the husband from even thinking he has leverage. And I want to add that good fences make good neighbors. And when you write, when you enter into a contract at the beginning of something and you spell out, the more you spell out in the contract what would happen when things break up, potentially, the better a contract it is. I think it makes people behave better, not worse. The fact that you mentioned at the time of the chuppah, oh, but you know, we don't want to talk about it, it's unromantic, that's ridiculous. Good fences make good neighbors. When the ground rules are clear and people know they can't fool around, that makes things a lot better. Okay, I'm going to stop now. My talmidim certainly can talk to me tomorrow if they need to.